WIOO Carlisle and WEEO Shippensburg.
Time for the Rick Smith Show.
I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chest. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore.
I don't want to abolish government. I simply want to reduce it to the size where I can drag it into the bathroom and drown it in the bathtub.
You bet I cut the taxes at the top.
How dare you? How dare you? Go ahead. Make my day.
The Rick Smith Show starts now.
Welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here tonight on the big program. We're going to talk about the blackmail that was, the hostage situation that has now been negotiated, and where we go from here. Our guests on the program tonight, Lori Wallach, director of Public Citizens Global Trade Watch. We're going to talk a little bit about the again, I'm just baffled by this, the South Korean Free Trade Agreement, how it is that the North is about ready to invade the South, and this steaming pile was the best agreement that we could come up with. We're going to talk about the details of that, some of the weird positions that have come about, and maybe your thoughts on it as well. Also in the second hour, we're going to talk with Steve Nathan. He is an unemployed worker, and I'm curious to get his take on the deal that has been reached, which I got to tell you, the blackmail was completed. The Republicans have this scorched earth philosophy. It's my way or the highway. You do what I say or nothing gets done. And Democrats haven't figured that out. What you have to understand is the Republicans could care less about people, especially those working people. Could care less about them, especially the unemployed, could really care less about them or their families. So when they took the position, and you knew they would, that they weren't going to extend unemployment benefits without several pounds of flesh. And I said it from the beginning, and today I had a couple people call me and say, how'd you know? How'd you know that was going to be the agreement? It doesn't take Nostradamus to figure this stuff out. They wanted their multi-hundred billions for the very top, for the very wealthy, and for the rest of us, a couple of crumbs. Personally, when I first started hearing about this, I was enraged. But at the end of the day, you have to understand what the Democrats are about, and that's about people. Right now, the Republicans, honestly and truthfully, get used to this. This is how it's going to be. They are going to take positions that are going to really show their disdain for the working people of this country, their hatred, if you will. And you're going to have Democrats who are going to have to compromise because they're not willing to see people starving in the street. They're not willing to see those who've already been kicked again. And the Republicans knew this. You go back, for years now. I mean, Dick Cheney said, look, the Democrats will cave. They always do. Because we're talking about people. And while I hate this agreement, again, I'm angry, I'm frustrated. I would like to have been more firm, because the reality in this is we are in a very serious economic recession. Now they tell us the recession is over, not for a lot of us. For a lot of us, we're still struggling to get by. We're still trying to figure out where the next meal is going to come from for our kids. But for the Wall Street types, for the bigwigs, hey, times have never been better. For corporate America, times have never been better. Things are great. It's the roaring 20s, and they're just partying like there's no tomorrow. Because profits are back. In fact, you know, as I've said a couple of times, corporate profits in the third quarter of this year were the highest in the history of this nation. That's an impressive statement, if you stop and think about it. The highest they have ever been. Ever. Ever. And what's amazing to me is there hasn't been an awful lot of outrage around this from people that I've talked to. Now, I've read a lot of outrage. I read the blogs. I read some of the other things. There's outrage there, but the average American, I don't know if we're not being given the right information, or we're just plain apathetic, where it's just, you know, this is how it's going to be. Get used to it. When the reality is these Republicans, these people, and a couple of bent-knee Democrats, be right about that. They don't care about the country. What they care about is they care about politics. They care about winning the game of politics. And they do. They win at politics. They can't govern worth a darn. But they can dream up slogans, and they can have one-liners and zingers. You know, Ronald Reagan had probably one of the most corrupt, destructive administrations in the history of the country. But boy, he could turn a phrase. He could hit that one-liner. They had perfect messaging. They got working people in this country to think that he was a great president because he had a message that people bought. Their lives didn't get much better, but the message was that we're exceptional, that we're superior, that we're better than everyone else. And I remember going through it. The Reagan years were not great years, no matter what people think. However revisionist history we come over. And now you look at the Bush years. Again, very good slogan, very good politicking, horrible governing. And again, it comes back down to something very simple. They're good at the game. They play the game very well. They play the game of politics very, very well. They've got their liners, they've got their stingers, they've got the messaging down. But they can't govern at all. So we suffer. And suffer mightily we will, and maybe that's a good thing. You know, going back to when the Bush recession started, one of the very first things that I said is, maybe we let this collapse. And I think, I really don't think that people understand how close to the edge we really were. And maybe by saving that pain and that misery has done us all a disservice. That's all I think of. Because you look at what happened on Saturday. And to me, Saturday was a watershed moment when you had four Democrats and then traitor Joe Lieberman who voted with all the Republicans to extend the Bush tax cuts for everybody. They refused to put it up to $500,000. Absolutely refused. 53-36 was the vote. They had to get to 60. Again, the filibuster rule. So then Chuck Schumer said, you know what? Let's raise that magic number up to $1 million. And only 0.3% will be affected by the tax increase. 0.3%. 99.7% of the people in the country, tax break. Still, all the Republicans, four Democrats, and a bent-knee independent from Connecticut. What'd we end up with? We ended up in this situation. So, you know, you got to stop and think how we got here as well. And I think Obama has laid out his plan for the next 2 years. Give the people what they want. They want the uber wealthy in control, done. They want a society where you're on your own, presto, you're on your own. You want to attack workers, bam, done.
Well, I can tell you this. Rick, from what I'm hearing, there's a lot of dissension in the ranks, and it's not just from the Democratic progressives. There's some blue dog Democrats that it sounds like they're going to oppose it. There's a conservative Republicans, one of them's your girlfriend, She's going to oppose it with a few of her friends. The Democrats, the Democratic leadership at least, publicly is saying we have the votes. Now, was that just for show? I don't know. There's some real rebellion. What was surprising, Rick, was he seemed to have more anger, or at least as much, at the opposition within his party as he did against the Republicans.
Figure that out.
And some Democrats are saying, well, you know, why didn't he show that anger, that kind of reaction, that kind of gut reaction? Why didn't he show that against the Republicans? And they're disappointed. They're disappointed. I have mixed emotions. I understand what the president's saying, but here's the bottom line. Here's the bottom line. He's going to increase the deficit. He's going to increase the chances that the Republicans will have more leverage to take more and more and more from the sacred cows that the Democrats have supported for decade after decade. That's what disappoints me. And this inheritance tax is another one. And some moderate Democrats like Landrieu, who, you know, behind the scenes are saying she was outraged. The Democrats didn't like the fact that he caved on that. He reduced it from 45% to 35%. That didn't sit well for the Democrats. So he might have a rebellion within his ranks.
Well, I think I think something's got to happen. Look, you cannot surrender like this. And look, I understand his position. Republicans, we're going to allow these unemployed folks to wither on the vine. We're going to let them go wherever they end up. And if you remember, these are the same voices who, during the great collapse, were saying, just let it go. The Pat Toomeys of the world who said, you know, it's just going to be a harder down. Let it collapse, and then we'll start over again. Because they know that the wealth class will be fine. The wealth class will be fine. They always are. And this, to me, is a reward for getting us into this mess. You got to understand who put us in this mess in the first place. This hasn't been just a couple of years in the making. This has been 30 years, 50 years of assaulting the federal government. Deregulation. And yeah, over the weekend, during our weekend show, I was talking about this movie called Other People's Money, because it had just popped into my head with Danny DeVito. And if you remember the movie, or the 80s at all, what happened is you had all these corporate raiders, and they would come up, and they would come and they would buy up these profitable companies who had large retirement funds, and they had big assets. Now, they weren't generating a lot of profit, but they were generating profit. So that in the movie, it was a wire place. They made, you know, one of the last companies to make wire in the U.S. So when DeVito come, he wanted to buy up all the shares and cut up everything so everybody could have a real quick profit. And that's what the 80s were about. Buy up profitable manufacturing places, take the pension funds, steal what you could, turn a quick buck, and screw the working class. And then you got into the 90s where we started with globalization, where we were just shipping jobs out of the country as fast as we could get them out. And then when Bush took office, it was full pedal to the metal. So we've been assaulting the working class of this country for a couple of generations now. So is it any surprise that we have to continue to give to the wealth class? I mean, I look at this Korean free trade agreement, and to me, here we're giving the investor class all of this wealth. Where do you think they're going to invest that? Where do you think that money is going to create jobs? Not here. And that's one of my great concerns. There are better ways to use these resources. There are better ways to build a society. There are better ways to educate our kids. And a little bit later on, we're going to talk education, because a new report just came out from China. And look, folks, we're getting our hats handed to us while you've got these scorched earth Republicans who, for love or money, you can't get them to do the right thing. But at some point, we're no longer going to be able to puff out our chest and say how great we are. At some point, we're no longer going to be number one because of these people. We're going to take a quick break. We're back after this.
Not not right wing, just right. The Rick Smith Show.
Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham.
These concessionary demands are unreasonable, unwarranted, and overly severe.
UAW Local 833 spokesman Dave Boucher on the cutthroat wage, pension, and benefits demands rejected by the workers at the Kohler Company plant in Wisconsin. The rejected concessions included 5-year wage and pension freezes, substantial hikes in health and other benefits costs, and a 2-tier workforce of new hires and recalled long-term layoffs who would be working at 65% of current pay with no union representation for the second-tier workers. Kohler and the UAW are trying to negotiate a new agreement that will be ratified by the 2,000 workers on Sunday. Public Citizen Global Trade Watch Director Lori Wallach says the Obama administration's Korea Free Trade Agreement is a betrayal of campaign promises Obama made to change NAFTA-style trade deals that have cost millions of U.S. jobs. The United Auto Workers Union supports the deal. The UAW says the Korea Free Trade Agreement will protect American auto jobs and grow more U.S. auto worker jobs. United Steelworkers President Leo Girard isn't buying it, and neither is the Machinists Union. Girard met with the USW board Monday to decide what to do on the issue. A statement is expected from the USW once its board has decided. Wallach says the Korea Free Trade Agreement is a U.S. job killer, and she's astounded by the UAW's support for it.
Maybe the most mortifying aspect of this whole thing is that the UAW has joined in on this betrayal that the Obama administration is perpetrating. Because specifically, the provisions that were negotiated in automobiles do not meet any of the criteria that the UAW itself had laid out as necessary for fixing this agreement so that it doesn't devastate U.S. auto workers as well as all of the related industries.
A new Pratt & Whitney contract will see two plants closed but 500 jobs preserved. Jesse Russell reports.
The 16-month battle between Pratt & Whitney and workers represented by the Machinist Union in Connecticut has come to a close. Under a contract agreed to by workers this weekend, aftermarket jet engine maintenance facilities in Cheshire and East Hartford will be shuttered by May of 2011. The Cheshire work will be moved to Georgia, while the East Hartford work will be moved to Japan and Singapore. In exchange for a 3% raise this year and two 2.5 raises over the next 2 years, the company has asked for 500 workers to retire early. Employees who accept the buyout will receive a $20,000 bonus, plus a week's pay for every year of employment with the company. Half of the company's workforce is over the age of 50, so the union expects to be able to find volunteers fairly easily. After months of tough talk by the company about needing to cut jobs, the announcement on Friday of a $1 billion 20-year contract with Airbus may have reduced some of the urgency of moving jobs out of Connecticut.
This newscast was made possible in part by the National Education Association. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Exposing that free trade is never free. The Rick Smith Show.
I got 800 miles of open border right outside my door. There's men and men in little pickup trucks who declared their own dang war. Now the government wants to build a barrier like old Berlin, 8 feet tall. But if Uncle Sam sends the illegals home, who's gonna build the wall?
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. You know, in talking about this South Korean free trade agreement, I have to be honest, I was surprised when the president of the United Auto Workers came out in favor of an agreement that had really, they had really adamantly opposed. Part of me thought it maybe it wasn't such a bad agreement. Part of me thought maybe the White House dangled the Employee Free Choice Act in their face again. I don't know. What I do know is I don't think I like it. I don't like it. How weak are our negotiators at a time when North Korea is chomping at the bit to invade that we can't even get a deal as good as the European Union got? And again, whose interests are being served? I say Wall Street's. Truth to be told, there are points about this I don't know, so I've asked for help. I've asked Lori Wallach. She is director of the Public Citizens Global Trade Watch. Publiccitizen.org is the website. Lori, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
You know, I'm looking at this thing, and I'm not getting it. Can you help me here? How did this happen?
I would say I go between being baffled and being furious. It's really hard to understand what is on the table is the free trade agreement that Bush signed, which is based almost word for word on NAFTA and CAFTA, that President Obama has laid out concerns with and had opposed during the campaign and as a senator. And the changes that were made, the announcements, were to delay the tariff phase out for certain for autos, but still ultimately get rid of them, and some other, well, tweaks. So the core stuff, like the investor offshoring protection, the financial deregulation, the ban, reference to the International Labor Organization Convention, all that stuff is in there. What's on the table now, and it's now owned by Obama.
Yeah, I started thinking back to the years, the Clinton years, when Clinton signed NAFTA. We know it was started late in the Reagan term. It was pretty much all negotiated during the Bush term, and Clinton signed right on the dotted line. And that's what popped into my head when I heard on Friday at 7 o'clock. I mean, there's another Bush tactic that just grabbed me and said something's wrong here.
Yes, the announcement was done at a time such that it was very hard for folks to get information or to react. And moreover, the notion that, especially at a time we have almost 10% unemployment, the Obama White House would choose to promote a trade agreement that the International Trade Commission, the independent government body that reviews trade agreements, said would increase the trade deficit, and that the Economic Policy Institute says would cost another 159,000 American jobs. It's just, a lot of Democrats in Congress, a lot of folks are just shocked.
I'm shocked, I got to be honest, because, here's the thing. I know who my enemies are. I do. I know the Republicans are not my friends. They're, for the most part, on trade issues, they can be considered enemies. But this just... He's my guy. He's the guy I supported. He's the guy who told me that we were going to look at renegotiating NAFTA. We were going to have labor standards and environmental standards. Are there any labor or environmental standards in this?
The language on environment and labor is the language that was in the Bush Agreement in 2007. And relative to NAFTA and CAFTA, that is better. But particularly with the labor chapter, there's some very serious problems that led most unions and the majority of Democrats to oppose the first agreement that has its rewritten standards, the Peru Free Trade Agreement. Probably the most pernicious problem is there was inserted by Bush a footnote into the labor chapter that explicitly prohibits reference to the International Labor Organization Convention, the treaties that set out the internationally recognized labor standards, when enforcing the labor chapter. So President Obama, as the senator, actually made a statement shortly after the Korea agreement was announced, saying that he was concerned about the environmental and labor standards, but not a word, not a comma has been changed.
That, to me, is just baffling. Because especially at this time, when we need jobs, to be saying, okay, we're gonna open up another one of these agreements. There's part of me that goes, is this a foreign policy ploy? A guy named Paul Craig Roberts had a great quote back in March, where he said the U.S. is one of the only countries around the world who gives their wealth away for nebulous foreign policy goals. Hey, part of me thought, could that be it? I mean, is this part of their foreign policy strategy that we're going to end up handing, another 150,000 jobs over the next 5 years away for some foreign policy aim? I'm just not getting it.
It's highly mysterious, and the administration is pitching it as a way to create jobs, but the actual government studies about the agreement fail to include the trade deficit. And what's really sad is there were ways to fix this agreement. So I think there was a lot of recognition that Obama had inherited a Bush agreement that was not good, and the Democrats in Congress, unions, groups like mine, had laid out some specific, limited things that needed to be done absolutely to denaftaize the worst provisions of the agreement. The foreign investor offshoring protection, for instance, fix that labor rights outrage. And this was their opportunity to do it, and they didn't.
Now, and the other part of this that bothers me, and I don't think it's something we talk about enough, is the fact that these trade agreements, we seem to focus on the job losses and on that stuff, but we don't seem to talk enough about how these agreements can shape, or I should say reshape, our laws and our ability to regulate what happens within our borders.
That's right. So the way these agreements work, which most people don't realize, that they're 900 pages. Most of it's actually not about trade. It sets forth all kinds of parameters that each signatory's domestic legislation, federal, state, has to meet. And countries that don't meet those rules are subject to challenges in foreign tribunals. Some of the provisions are even enforceable by private companies at United Nations and World Bank tribunals. And the kind of constraints are things like limits on financial regulation, limits on the ability to regulate banks because they get too big, limits on the ability to ban dangerous, risky new products or services. These are the kind of improvements that were recently passed, not just in the U.S., but in Korea. There are limits on how we can regulate foreign investors operating here. And this is a very serious problem in this agreement, because there are 300 Korean establishments established now in the U.S. who under this agreement would have new rights to attack U.S. laws that they say undermine their future profits in World Bank and UN tribunals, demanding compensation from us, the taxpayer.
You know, if it weren't so perverse, I would laugh. If it weren't so bad, I would have to laugh at this. But this is the kind of stuff we've gotten ourselves into.
Well, we haven't gotten ourselves into this one yet. So,
do you think there's much chance of stopping this?
Yes. In the House of Representatives, this is going to be a huge food fight. And the reason why is in this past election, 208 candidates, including many of them who ran and succeeded, and who are Republicans, ran against the trade status quo. So you have a huge block now of incoming freshmen who are Tea Party endorsed. The Tea Party, for a variety of reasons, is opposed to more of these agreements. They undermine our sovereignty. They undermine the manufacturing base. And those Republicans, plus the Republicans for whom either, for instance, because they're in the textile sector, because there was a horrible giveaway in the textile sector, or because they have longstanding been supporters of working people. There are a variety of Republicans who vote, for instance, in favor of different labor provisions for building trades, like David Bacon. If you take those Republicans and add them to the Democrats, if the House Democrats stick together, you have a majority again.
That means we should be calling our congressmen early and often.
House of Representatives. The senators, for a variety of reasons, are not going to decide this. So folks need to, right away, because the Chamber of Commerce has kicked up a huge campaign, need to call the members of Congress. And if you had a Democrat lose and get replaced by a conservative Republican, call them. Because all of these freshman Republicans are going to have to stand election in 2 years when they're, unfortunately, probably still going to be high unemployment. And the whole country, the polling shows, Wall Street Journal, NBC poll, Democrats, Republicans, especially Tea Party Republicans, oppose more of the same NAFTA agreement. So we have the ability, if we do the legwork, to pin down our representatives, and we need to call them up, tell them, where do you stand in Korea? If you support the Korea FTA, more job-filling NAFTA-style agreement, we oppose you. And it's very easy to call. You can go in the blue pages of your phone book. They have local offices. Or there's a switchboard at the Capitol where all you need is your zip code, and they'll connect you to the right representative. 202-225-3121. Everyone should just put that in their fridge for every time that they're annoyed. Put it on a thick pad on your fridge. 202-225-3121.
I've got it on speed dial on my phone. Because I call often, early and often. But, you know, on Thursday we're going to have Congressman Joe Sestak here on the program. I will most certainly bring this up to him because I think this is important. It's something that he ran on.
Yep.
So let me ask you this, Lori. We can't stop trade agreements, and we shouldn't be stopping all trade agreements. What should we have, what should have Obama done? What alternatives would there have been that you guys suggest over at Global Trade Watch?
Well, this is what's particularly depressing about the situation, because it's not a question of no trade versus trade. The question is what rules, who benefits from them, and who gets to write them. So this old Bush-Korea agreement is based on NAFTA. We know how that model works. The country's against it, a lot of members of Congress are against it, and 150 members of Congress got in legislation this past Congress called the TRADE Act, Trade Reform Accountability Development and Employment Act, that laid out what a good trade agreement would look like, one that would actually help us create jobs by boosting exports, but wouldn't promote the export of our jobs by giving all kinds of special protections for offshore. It's totally doable, but Obama didn't.
Yeah, I'm frustrated. One of the key provisions that caught my eye was 35% domestic content on automobiles. You know, again, you know, China, I know, is in the process of making their own cars. I know Ford, I know GM, they all have subsidiaries there. At some point, you know, China is going to take over even more than they have. So to me, when I saw that, I said, you know, this could be a backdoor way in which the Chinese build cars with a Korean name on them and get in here because of this trade agreement.
Well, perhaps one of the richer ironies is that all of us who learn about the problems with this agreement, auto provisions, learn from the UAW's excellent statements and testimony. And one of their most recent statements, just from September this year, said because of that dreadful 35%, only 35% of content has to be American or Korean for an automobile to get trade agreement treatment. So they pointed out that 65% of a car could have content from China and come here from Korea duty-free. The agreement even newly allows the Korean government to pay back the Korean companies for the tariffs they have to pay on the Chinese parts if the final car is sent here. And so they said, unless we change the rules, like a free trade agreement with the whole region, i.e. China, Thailand, Philippines, where there's a lot of very low-wage production. For parts, for workers here who make glass, who make tires, who make steel, make auto parts, even if we got more cars into Korea, 65% of the content of our alleged new exports could be from Mexico or from China. Even the European Union, which just signed an agreement with Korea themselves, got a majority content rule. 55% is what's required in their agreement for the car to get special treatment.
So why then did the UAW president come out and support this? I mean, I would have to think that he supported it even before he even read it, I would think.
I don't know. I haven't spoken to President King, and it would be an interesting question I guess to ask him on the interview.
Yeah, because I'm just not getting it. Again, I know the other unions have been silent on this. I guess they want to read it. They want to evaluate it for themselves. But for me, not much has changed in this. So on a visceral level, I got to be honest, I'm opposed to more NAFTA-type agreements, just as a matter of course.
As I understand it, several unions will be issuing statements tomorrow against the agreement, with more coming out as the week goes along, because they've now been able to really review what the parameters of the changes were. We all knew what the old Bush-Korea agreement was. Everyone was against it strongly. So the real question is to find out what exactly the changes were, try and figure out what they mean, and then decide. The changes were pretty modest. And one of the things that didn't get changed was that 35% content rule. There's also nothing in the agreement that actually would require Korea to buy more U.S. cars. So right now, Korea buys about 6,000 of our cars, and sends us about a half a million of theirs.
Now, what does that say about us?
It means we have a huge honking trade deficit, and that's gutting out our entire manufacturing base, and it's policies that are in our control that are causing it, and this will be more of the same.
Yeah, and you know, I love Hyundai keeps saying, we build cars in America down in Alabama. With this agreement, I got to be honest, part of me thinks that as soon as they don't have to be here. They're going to go back.
That's a very good question.
Interesting, interesting. Again, we're going to keep on top of this. Lori Wallach, Director of Public Citizens Global Trade Watch. Citizen.org is their website. Lori, I appreciate your time, and I hope you'll come back again real soon.
Whenever I can. Thank you.
All righty. We're going to take a quick break. Right back with your calls. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425.
Center of the working class majority. Rick Smith.
Excellent news, people. After 3 years of financial doldrums and depression, money is on the move again. The economy is beginning to hum, and bluebirds of happiness are twittering with delight. People are starting to shake off what happened, trilled one of those bluebirds. The mood is absolutely better, exclaimed another. There is a definite buzz on the street, chirped yet another happy songster. Of course, none of these merry optimists are talking about your street or mine. Instead, the new surge of economic exuberance is being felt exclusively by those fortunate ones on Wall Street and in the executive suites of giant corporations. For example, the big five Wall Street firms, Bank of America, Citigroup, Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley, and J.P. Morgan Chase, have set aside $90 billion this year to lavish huge bonuses on their big-shot bankers. $90 billion. Also, major corporations are hauling in total profits this year of $1.7 trillion, the highest level ever recorded. Ever. Thus, reports the New York Times, the moneyed elites are walking with renewed swagger and indulging themselves once again with extravagances that we commoners cannot imagine. One insurance executive, for example, has doubled her annual cosmetic surgery budget this year. Then there's the Goldman Sachs executive who celebrated Halloween with a posh party of 1,000 of his best friends in a hip Manhattan nightclub. His bash featured an open bar and a performance by hip-hop star Lil' Kim, who appeared in a black cat costume. This is Jim Hightower saying, trick or treat, y'all. As these privileged pranksters play, the majority of Americans remain mired in a miserable, jobless economy with incomes falling, the middle class sinking, and poverty rising. As one Wall Street economist starkly says, this is unlikely to change in 2011 or 2012.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Time to rearrange. Keeping the chambers of commerce within their gated communities. The Rick Smith Show.
Back to the Rick Smith Show, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. The latest Borowitz report. In his latest effort to find common ground with Republicans in Congress, President Barack Obama said today that he was willing to agree that he is a Muslim. Differences over his religious orientation have been a sore point between the president and his Republican foes for the past 2 years, but in agreeing that he is a Muslim, Mr. Obama is sending a clear message that he is trying to find consensus. The American people do not want to see us fighting in Washington, Mr. Obama told reporters at the White House. They want to see us working together to improve their lives, and Allah willing, we will. But Mr. Obama's willing to back down on his claims of being a Christian does not seem to satisfy his Republican opposition. As GOP leader John Boehner said today, he insisted that the president must go also and agree that he was born in Kenya. While Mr. Obama did not immediately agree to Mr. Boehner's demand, he hinted that yet another compromise might be in the offing. My place of birth has been and will always be negotiable, he said. The White House sources indicated today the president might be willing to meet with GOP staff halfway on his birthplace and say he was born somewhere in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean. Elsewhere, moments after his capture in London, WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange said, "I knew I shouldn't have signed up for Foursquare." And that is our Borowitz report. Of course, Foursquare is a site where you can map where you've been so you can tell all your friends where you are all the time. What happened to "I don't want to talk to you"? I don't know. Amazing stuff. But, you know, I look at this tax thing. And the New York Times had an interesting piece, and it went through this whole tax thing, this whole compromise, if you want to call it that. I call it a surrender, but it is what it is. The package is going to cost about $900 billion over the next 2 years, so much for the national debt. All of that money will be borrowed, another $900 billion. And you stop and think about it. You know, you got everybody worried about the national debt and all these long-term fiscal problems, but yet we just had to hand out that big chunk of change to those at the very top. It's also going to reduce the 6.2% Social Security payroll tax on all wage earners by 2 points for the next year, claiming to put more money into workers' paychecks. For me, I think this is a bad idea, but we'll talk about that a little later. For a family earning $50,000 a year, it would amount to a savings of about $1,000. For a worker slated to pay the maximum tax, which is $6,621.60 on an income of $106,800, they'd save about $2,136, which they say is going to be a big stimulus. Not quite so sure. The top rate of 15% on capital gains and dividends will stay in place. The alternative minimum tax will be adjusted downward so that another $21 million are missed. Again, more revenue going out the door. There is a 13-month extension for unemployment. Again, that's what we should have been talking about all along. Congressional Republicans have been blocking efforts, and we talked about that before on Saturday. They, you know, adamantly opposed to even rational increases for the top 2 or the top 0.3%. And here's the key to this. White House officials said they feared a long standoff would see benefits end for millions of Americans over the holiday season and in the months ahead. And, yeah, you're going to. And this is part of that scorched earth mentality. This is part of we don't give a rat's behind about anyone. We just want to win. And they won, pure and simple.
Well, you know, Rick, I mean, the reality is Republicans in 2 years are going to be back and they'll want another extension of the tax breaks. I mean, that's the reality. The question I have, why didn't the Democrats and the Obama administration, why didn't they head this problem off earlier? I mean, they probably couldn't have picked a worse time than in a lame duck session to give the Republicans much more leverage than they did now. Why didn't they take care of this problem earlier? Just another tactical blunder.
Again, they're not good at politicking, just not at all. And back to the article, Obama made substantial concessions to Republicans. We know that. In addition to dropping his opposition to the extension of the current income tax rates above $250,000 for couples and $200,000 for individuals, he agreed to a deal on the federal estate tax. Again, another handout, exempting above $5 million, up to $5 million. You pay above that per person, that 35% rate. And this is, you know, got some Democrats just nuts. And who was behind it? Blanche Lincoln. So again, you go, are we surprised? Are we surprised that the Walmart sister, one of the Walmart twins were there? No, not at all surprised. It's just, you know, I got to be honest. I'm just frustrated by this. But the president did have this to say. He said, "I'm not willing to let working families across this country become collateral damage for political warfare here in Washington." And he said the deal included pieces that would help working class families and accelerate the economic recovery. So John Boehner and Mitch McConnell, they were all tingly in the panties, happy as can be because they won, and they didn't have to feel the wrath of the unemployed. which I said, you know, you should have done. I think I would have. I would have rolled those dice. Because, look, we're handing out all this money to the top with very little help for those who really need it. When we come back, I want to talk a little bit more about this and get your calls. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. We're right back after this.
It is all about the children, even after they're born. Rick Smith.
If you or a loved one has suffered a workplace injury, don't jeopardize your benefits by not fully knowing your rights. Don't be misled by those whose job it is to minimize your injury, your disability, your lifetime medical coverage, and your financial recovery. Order your free book by Calhoun Associates by visiting workinjurynpa.com or calling 695-4722. Don't be taken advantage of. Get your copy of The Seven Deadly Sins That Can Destroy Your Pennsylvania Workers' Compensation Case by visiting workinjurynpa.com or calling 717-695-4722.
Is that old washer or dryer on the fritz and you don't have the bucks for a new one?
Call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
You say that old refrigerator isn't refrigerating so well.
Call Mike at Klein's, 243-3211.
How about a bunch of money to replace your old stove or microwave?
Again, save the cost of a new one. Just call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Here at the radio station, we call Mike our resident mechanical and electronics genius. Have you ever met someone who can literally fix anything? That's Mike.
Call him at 243-3211.
You'd be amazed to learn how well many of the older appliances were made. A simple repair might give you another 5, 10, or even 20 years of service from that old washer, dryer, stove, or refrigerator at a fraction of the cost of a new one. Mike repairs TVs and electronics, too.
So call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Let Mike fix it right, and you pocket the savings.
That's 243-3211 for Mike at Klein's Appliances Repair Service.
Bringing sanity and rational thought back to America. Rick Smith.
Well, that's about what's happened here. That is about what's happened here. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. What are your thoughts? Was this the right thing to do? Did the president do the right thing? Because, look, you know the Republicans were going to stand their ground regardless of who they harmed. That's how they are. They don't give a tinker's damn about you or anybody else. Well, I shouldn't say that. They care about the very wealthy, obviously. And the top 0.3%, really, because they wouldn't even compromise on that. There is no compromise there. And I got to be honest, part of me thinks that's why some people like them. That they stick to their principles, stick to their values, no matter who gets hurt, or even if they're wrong, which most of the time they are.
And, you know, it seemed that most of the Democrats, when you talk to them, and they expressed their opposition to what the president's doing, they said, look, this was a major promise of his campaign.
Yep.
And it's just another reason for people to say, you see, Obama really isn't an effective leader.
But there's good news, I think. As we move into the 2012 presidential election, it appears that the Republican National Committee, the RNC, is about $25 million in debt. And again, it's a matter of poor fundraising. It's a matter of horrible financial mismanagement. Their chief counsel there, their general counsel, David Norcross, says it's the biggest debt the National Committee has ever had going into a presidential election cycle. And these are the people who are going to fix the deficit. These are the folks who are going to balance the budget. They can't even balance their own. And they've got deep, deep pockets. But here's the thing. There are some good things in this, and we should talk about that a little bit. There's a child tax credit, $1,000 a kid. So it's going to help, they say it's reported to help some 10.5 million families with about 18 million children. That's not a bad thing, I don't think. It's going to help with college tuition. There'll be a tax credit there, which, if you remember, was part of the Recovery Act. So they've extended this. It's $2,500 to help pay for, you know, tuition, books, and all the other costs that go along with it. It is going to extend unemployment insurance for another 13 months. But those of you who have been unemployed since the Bush year, you're screwed. You're out in the cold. No help there. The business investment tax is going to be redone. It's going to allow businesses to spend to pretty much deduct all of their investment capital. So if you buy a, you run a landscaping business, you buy a lawnmower, you can deduct 100% of that cost. Here at the program, when we buy a new board or microphones or whatever, we get to deduct 100% of that. I think it's a good thing. There's some bad to this 2% payroll tax thing. To me, not a great idea. Two reasons. One, politically, it's a failure. Because much like we saw with the tax cuts for 95% of the people in the country, 44% of them didn't even know they got it. This is another one of those things that people aren't going to know they got. They're going to wake up one morning, it's going to be in their check, and they're never going to notice it. Unlike when Bush gave handouts out, he actually sent you a letter telling you that your handout was coming. So you'd get all excited because, oh, my God, oh, goodness, my Bush handout's coming. My lottery winnings are in the mail. Check's in the mail. And you'd run out there every single day. Oh, it's going to be there today. Open the box. Oh, maybe tomorrow. And then one day it was there. And you were glad. And you knew where it came from. As a matter of politics, that is brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. But, again, going back to what I said at the beginning, Republicans are brilliant
strategicians.
There you go. They're brilliant at that. They're brilliant at the game. They're great at politics. Governing, not so good. Because when they sent out those letters, it cost a lot of money. When they sent out those checks, cost a lot of money. See, they understand PR. Like when Walmart sent $8 million of water down to New Orleans and spent $18 million promoting the fact that they sent $8 million worth of water down to New Orleans. Kind of that. Instead of just sending $26 million worth of water and doing the right thing, they had to puff their chest out and see, look how wonderful we are. This is that kind of thing. The other part of this, I don't think, and I'm sorry, I don't think cutting funding going into Social Security at a time where we're talking about its trouble is a great idea. I don't think cutting the pot is a great idea. Find another way to get money into workers' pockets. Like, oh, I don't know. Maybe allowing them to organize and to negotiate for better wages, hours, and conditions. Maybe saying, you know, some of those corporate profits that have never been greater, you know, that $1.7 trillion in pure in their pocket profit, maybe that could be divvied a little differently. Yeah, just a thought.
Well, one idea that you came up with, which I thought was a good idea in Social Security, was to half the tax but totally lift the cap. Now,
absolutely.
What if they triple or quadruple it just, you know, in the short term? Well, maybe, but they didn't get that. But I agree with you. That's a bad idea if all you're doing is cutting the taxes in half.
Yep. And the ugly part of this is obviously the fact that we've given hundreds of billions of dollars away to the top 2%, the top 0.3%, folks who really are not desperate. Now, look, I'm one of these folks who say, you know what, we're in a tough time. We need to sacrifice. We need to pitch in and help. So by not asking the top 2%, who we're talking about $83 billion a year. $83 billion that we handed them for each of the next two years. Asking them to forego that, because, look, they're doing okay. They're doing just fine. That's adding to our debt. And then this estate tax thing, a 35% rate for anything over $5 million per person, to me, I got to be honest, brain dead. The original estate tax, pushed forward by a Republican president and a Republican Congress, 70%. Anything over a million. And the first person to pay that was Rockefeller. And you know what? His kids are still pretty well off. They can get a little extra cheese on their hamburger. Maybe on a good day, you know, the upsize fry. That's a big one, too. They can afford that as well. To me, again, you know, it comes down to some bizarre stuff. Story from the New York Times. You're going to love this. Absolutely going to love this. Congress is debating new tax rates. And that has Wall Street nervously eyeing their calendar, worried that lawmakers will allow taxes to rise for the wealthiest Americans beginning next year. Financial firms are discussing whether to move up their bonus payments, you know, the big handouts that they give to their executives, to this year, sometime at the end of this month, for next year. So historically, they give them out, you know, January, February. Now they're going, well, we should move that up so we can avoid paying our share of taxes. And they're saying what they said at the time, and now this is before we had the grand agreement, at stake a portion of the hefty annual payouts that are a familiar part of compensation culture on Wall Street, as well as a juicy target for popular anger if Congress doesn't extend the Bush handouts for the highest income level. A typical worker who earns $1 million a year would pay taxes of $40,000 to $50,000 next year, depending on their base salary. So, you know, I'm looking at this and I'm going, okay, now they've got the agreement. So they had their big meeting. They had the coffee and the donuts brought in so that they could have their meeting. And in the meeting, they decided we're gonna give these handouts this year. And now that this thing is done, I think they're going to have another meeting and say, well, since we already decided that we should get handouts this year, maybe, since we don't have a problem, we'll give ourselves a handout next year, too. See how great that is? You got to love Wall Street. And now stop and think about this for a second. We've handed out all this money. You know, these millionaires, they don't want to pay their $40,000 to $50,000. But you've got the people we've called heroes, our military people, who right now are facing a 1.4% raise. This is the lowest amount since 1962 when they didn't give a raise at all. And what's going on is the administration, they're going to freeze all non-military pay for all federal workers because they want to bring down the deficit. And now they're saying this 1.4% raise for military personnel would match the private sector. It's going to match the private sector. Let me get this straight. I'm having a hard time here, and maybe you can help. We're going to give out a couple $100 billion to the top 2%, yet we can't find money to pay our troops. And now they're just looking for just a half a percent more, which would be about $350 million more. $350 million. We're handing out a couple $100 billion to the top 2%. The total cost of this raise, and look, I got to be honest, this is not that 1.9% is what they were asking for, but it's about $2 billion, about $2 billion. That's it.
Why would that surprise you, Rick? If you remember what happened to the Bush administration, the president himself.
Oh, I'm sorry.
He opposed the bill. He opposed the bill to take care of those soldiers coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan that had deep emotional and mental problems.
Yep.
Opposed it. Right. How could you oppose that?
It is what it is. We're right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425.
Family values are more than slogans. The Rick Smith Show.
The Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham.
These concessionary demands are unreasonable, unwarranted, and overly severe.
UAW Local 833 spokesman Dave Boucher on the cutthroat wage, pension, and benefits demands rejected by the workers at the Kohler Company plant in Wisconsin. The rejected concessions included 5-year wage and pension freezes, substantial hikes in health and other benefits costs, and a 2-tier workforce of new hires and recalled long-term layoffs who would be working at 65% of current pay with no union representation for the second-tier workers. Kohler and the UAW are trying to negotiate a new agreement that will be ratified by the 2,000 workers on Sunday. Public Citizen Global Trade Watch Director Lori Wallach says the Obama administration's Korea Free Trade Agreement is a betrayal of campaign promises Obama made to change NAFTA-style trade deals that have cost millions of U.S. jobs. The United Auto Workers Union supports the deal. The UAW says the Korea Free Trade Agreement will protect American auto jobs and grow more U.S. auto worker jobs. United Steelworkers President Leo Girard isn't buying it, and neither is the Machinists Union. Girard met with the USW board Monday to decide what to do on the issue. A statement is expected from the USW once its board has decided. Wallach says the Korea Free Trade Agreement is a U.S. job killer, and she's astounded by the UAW's support for it.
Maybe the most mortifying aspect of this whole thing is that the UAW has joined in on this betrayal that the Obama administration is perpetrating, because specifically the provisions that were negotiated in automobiles do not meet any of the criteria that the UAW itself had laid out as necessary for fixing this agreement so that it doesn't devastate U.S. auto workers as well as all of the related industries.
A new Pratt & Whitney contract will see 2 plants closed but 500 jobs preserved. Jesse Russell reports.
The 16-month battle between Pratt & Whitney and workers represented by the Machinist Union in Connecticut has come to a close. Under a contract agreed to by workers this weekend, aftermarket jet engine maintenance facilities in Cheshire and East Hartford will be shuttered by May of 2011. The Cheshire work will be moved to Georgia, while the East Hartford work will be moved to Japan and Singapore. In exchange for a 3% raise this year and 2.5 raises over the next 2 years, the company has asked for 500 workers to retire early. Employees who accept the buyout will receive a $20,000 bonus plus a week's pay for every year of employment with the company. Half of the company's workforce is over the age of 50, so the union expects to be able to find volunteers fairly easily. After months of tough talk by the company about needing to cut jobs, the announcement on Friday of a $1 billion 20-year contract with Airbus may have reduced some of the urgency of moving jobs out of Connecticut.
This newscast was made possible in part by the National Education Association. You've been listening to WIND, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Uncovering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
Doilies and our finger up in the air, a little finger up in the air, the whole nine yards. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. What do you think about this? I think it's another example of Republicans being politically very smart and Democrats being, well, quite candidly stupid. Or to be honest, thinking about others more than not. Because I just don't think that they can possibly turn their back on the working people, even if they don't do what I think they should be doing most of the time. Shankar Venenum, he has a piece over at Slate that I thought was interesting. It's called Smart Republicans, Dumb Democrats. And I thought it was funny. He says, if Democrats are the big spenders, why do Republican states get the money? One of the co-chairs of President Obama's bipartisan debt reduction council recently got into trouble for telling a woman's group that Social Security had now reached a point where it was like a milk cow with 300 teats. And if you guessed, it was the Republican co-chairman and not a Democrat who said it. It was Alan Simpson. And we've talked about this in the past. He goes on to say Republicans have a near monopoly on complaints about government spending. Dozens of new Tea Party candidates were elected to Congress on the promise to clean house. But data going back 2 decades, to stick to Simpson's crude metaphor, show the milk is mostly coming from Democratic states and the sucking is being done by Republican states. And, you know, we've known that for quite some time. If you look at Alaska, for instance, Alaska sends a dollar to Washington, and they end up getting $1.64 back. You think about it, you go, that's great. How does Pennsylvania get that? Because for every dollar that Pennsylvania sends, we get about 93 cents back. For every dollar that Massachusetts sends, they get about 82 cents back. And I got to be honest, it kind of makes me nuts when I hear these southern states say, well, we want government out of our lives. Well, then get out of my pocket. It's just, I don't know. Let's go to the phone lines. Got Gary on line one. How are we doing today, Gary?
We're doing great, Rick. Good interview earlier. I enjoyed listening to your guest. I wanted to talk briefly about the descriptions that we use now in politics, and it's down to Republicans and Democrats and conservatives and liberals. And we occasionally talk about the evil socialists, and we'll even drop the F-bomb every once in a while, the fascists. But nobody seems to mention the elephant in the room.
The corporatists.
Well, the capitalist, and you're very close. I think we agree, at least on the terminology. Capitalism is what's driving our government. It's what's driving the world government. It's not whether you're a Republican or a Democrat or what side of the aisle you sit. The sole purpose of the capitalist is to make more capital, and the middle class is an acceptable collateral damage of capitalism. Whether it be NAFTA or CAFTA or Korea or any form of one-sided trade agreements that this country gets into, I would ask, in history, when can we remember when a larger economy does business with a smaller economy? Does the smaller economy rise to the level of the larger, or does the larger economy fall to the level of the smaller? And that seems to be what's happened. I mean, this nation now is addicted to garbage that we import from other worlds.
Yep.
And I wonder, what do we get in return? What are we getting from Colombia, from Bolivia, from China that is so great that we can't produce this ourselves? And that's not even the question. The question is, capitalists make the decisions as to where products come from, what it will be sold as, and the availability of it in the marketplace. And we're really kind of along for the ride. And I look to, we all, I think, look to Washington. And, you know, whether you're a Republican or a Democrat, and you look to your party where your beliefs are kind of, where you kind of hold your beliefs, and you expect them to do what's right for the country. I believe that Republicans, even the staunchest conservatives, believe that what they're doing is right for the country, just as much as I believe that the most liberal Democrat believes that what they're doing is right for the country. But the capitalist doesn't care. The capitalist is only interested in making money from wherever they possibly can. And that's off of your back and mine.
Absolutely agree. You know, at the end of this, what they figured out how to do is they figured out how to shift the blame onto the Democrats, and Democrats keep falling for it. I'm looking at this trade agreement, and I'm infuriated. Because this is a guy that I supported. This is a guy who looked me in the eye and said, I will support fair trade agreements that value workers' rights, that value environmental protections, and this just does not reach that bar.
We had in the Bush administration, the director of the head of the Department of Labor, a female, and I don't
Chow.
Remember what her name
is. Elaine Chao.
Elaine Chao, thank you. Actually said she thought that jobs being farmed out of this country and other nations was good for this economy. What are you breathing to think that that's a logical approach to making this country great again in regards to gross national product, in regards to manufacturing? We've relied upon those things. Those are our strong points, and we've allowed them to slip away.
Well, don't you know, Gary, we get cheap goods. We have a better standard of living because we've got more cheap plastic crap from China.
Yeah, we get Barbie dolls with lead paint on them, and dog food with arsenic and all kinds of good things from China. But we don't have jobs, and none of those will ever come back as long as we continue to sign these ridiculous trade agreements.
And, you know, to me, again, you know, I look at this, and I didn't get into it with Lori because I don't really want, I didn't know where her position is. But for me, I'm looking at North Korea about ready to invade South Korea. I think that's a pretty big bargaining chip because the South really needs our backing. And yeah, this is the best agreement you could get with that kind of a bargaining chip? Really? A 35% domestic content rule? I mean, that is laughable.
Yeah, yeah. What is the expectation? Maybe if someone can explain that to me, the expectation of what that means for the betterment of this nation. I don't know how that can be explained to any of us.
Well, at the end of it,
and make it believable.
Right, but at the end of it, it's who are they negotiating for? And yeah, as you pointed out from the very beginning, they pass these things for the capitalists, for the financiers, which is one of the first thing that comes down is the border to capital, so that money can flow in and out of countries unregulated, untaxed, unencumbered. It can go wherever it wants, as fast as it wants. Which, you know, as I've talked about before, you look at Argentina after 9/11. All the hot money left Argentina, the country collapsed. That's the world we're going to live into, where these corporatists have the ability to go around any country in the globe and us eventually at some point, pull their money out, and we, the working people, we suffer because we will have privatized all of our social services, all of our public works program, all that stuff privatized. And they're talking about it here.
Yes, they are.
We're just not hearing it. Think about this for a second. The top marginal tax rate in this country at one point was 92% back in 1955. What this debt commission suggested was a top marginal rate of 23%. That is 50 years of conservatism in the making. That's all these think tanks and all of these organizations that the Chamber of Commerce has funded over the years getting their wet dream, if you will.
Surprisingly, the Chamber of Commerce isn't commerce. It's the act of this nation being productive. That's what business is. And they're promoting something which kind of almost flies in the face of their own rhetoric.
Well, what they're doing is who's got the biggest dollar?
Yeah,
I mean, you got a bunch of people who are horse chasing the buck. That's all it's about.
Well, you know, I'll leave you with this, and I think you alluded to this earlier in the show, and you've alluded to it in past shows. You've had a Bush administration that gave hundreds of billions of dollars away to keep the cash flowing on Wall Street. You have an Obama administration that gave hundreds of billions of dollars away to make sure that cash flowed, and we hemmed and hawed and bickered about a few million for unemployment to keep Americans eating at the table. And, man, I tell you, that brings a tear to my eye.
Mine too. Gary, I appreciate the call. Thank you.
You betcha. Thank you, guys.
All right. You know, and look, I mean, that's the end of this. And we said that from the beginning. We were going to hand out billions of dollars to the top just for the privilege of some unemployed folks who lost their jobs not through anything that they did. They want to show up to work every day. They want to work hard. They want to earn a paycheck. It was that these corporatists left.
Absolutely. If I could make a comment just for a second about this, you know, the big vote we're talking about. You know, Obama seems to say, and I understand where he's coming from, he seemed to say, look, if we don't do this, too many Americans are going to suffer. Here's the problem. He keeps making decisions like this, and he keeps disappointing the voters, and he keeps going back on his promises. And guess what? He ain't going to be there to protect the working people after 4 years if he keeps it up. In fact, there are some Democrats now. Whether it comes to fruition, I don't know. There's some Democrats that are that outraged that they are starting to look for something to run against.
That's
now,
a little early.
Now that I know it is, and the likelihood of that is pretty slim now. However, just the fact that they're that angry and that disappointed that they're willing to look for someone who is willing to run against the president. If I were President Obama, I'd be worried. I'd be worried because you're going to need the support of every Democrat in that Congress the next 2 years.
Well, we will see, and that's why we're going to be here. It's going to be an interesting year, I think. I think next year is going to be quite interesting. We're going to take a quick break. Right back with our unemployed worker guest, Steve Nathan. Stick around. We're right back after this.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Excellent news, people. After 3 years of financial doldrums and depression, money is on the move again. The economy is beginning to hum, and bluebirds of happiness are twittering with delight. People are starting to shake off what happened, trilled one of those bluebirds. The mood is absolutely better, exclaimed another. There is a definite buzz on the street, chirped yet another happy songster. Of course, none of these merry optimists are talking about your street or mine. Instead, the new surge of economic exuberance is being felt exclusively by those fortunate ones on Wall Street and in the executive suites of giant corporations. For example, the big five Wall Street firms, Bank of America, Citigroup, Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley, and J.P. Morgan Chase, have set aside $90 billion this year to lavish huge bonuses on their big shot bankers. $90 billion. Also, major corporations are hauling in total profits this year of $1.7 trillion, the highest level ever recorded. Ever. Thus, reports the New York Times, the moneyed elites are walking with renewed swagger and indulging themselves once again with extravagances that we commoners cannot imagine. One insurance executive, for example, has doubled her annual cosmetic surgery budget this year. Then there's the Goldman Sachs executive who celebrated Halloween with a posh party of 1,000 of his best friends in a hip Manhattan nightclub. His bash featured an open bar and a performance by hip-hop star Lil' Kim, who appeared in a black cat costume. This is Jim Hightower saying, trick or treat, y'all. As these privileged pranksters put, the majority of Americans remain mired in a miserable, jobless economy with incomes falling, the middle class sinking, and poverty rising. As one Wall Street economist starkly says, this is unlikely to change in 2011 or 2012.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Your proud defender of the working class majority, Rick Smith.
Well, the greenbacks are tumbling, I'll tell you that. They're tumbling right into the pots of the top 1%, if you will, according to a new Citizens for Tax Justice report. The tax cut framework deal with Republican congressional leaders and President Obama would, if adopted, and there's a chance it may not, would send 25.4% of all of the benefits in this $900 billion package, a quarter of that, more than a quarter, going to go to the top 1%. Think about that for a second. That, to me, is unconscionable. Especially when you're using unemployed workers, when you're using unemployment insurance as the gun to hold everybody hostage with. It's just an absolute shame. But what we've been doing here on the program is we've reached out to unemployed workers. We want to hear what their stories are and how this whole process has affected them. Tonight I've got Steve Nathan on the line. Steve, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
I'm looking at this agreement. We gave a whole bunch away to get a very little. It's frustrating to me. I'm curious what your thoughts are.
I have a lot of thoughts about this. First of all, I'm one of the 99ers out there that was not even considered in today's agreement or yesterday's agreement. And I was really offended by what I heard from Joe Biden's financial advisor saying that the 99ers should think about switching careers. Well, that would be fine, except that I have basic needs that have to be met, too, just like everyone else that's going to be receiving benefits.
I didn't see that. Where did you get that from?
I saw that today on CNN.
I got to find that, because that's absolutely ridiculous, considering that there are five people, and this is just the average, five unemployed workers for every available job. So even if you changed careers, there's no guarantee that there's a job there. Now, I'm in favor of job training, and I'm in favor of getting people different skills. But to say something like that to me, callous and stupid.
Exactly. And the career that I was in, well, still I'm in, is a paralegal, which is supposed to be recession-proof. However, law firms and corporate law departments have taken hits over the past couple of years to the point that there are law firms, large law firms, that have actually shut down.
Really?
So I'm up against thousands of attorneys as well as other paralegals and other staffers, including law clerks, law students, that are looking for work similar to what I'm looking for.
And when did you lose your job?
A little over 2 years ago. I worked at a firm in Center City, Philadelphia. I was only there for a short time. During the time when they had a large case in progress, I was let go at that time because they were able to get a 6 month continuance, which meant they were able to extend the time before they were able to go to trial with this particular case. But prior to that, I did have temporary positions elsewhere, and I was with a firm in Valley Kenwood just outside Philadelphia for years. Another part of this that affected me was that I worked in Delaware for one day, and because of that, I lost $8,000 to Pennsylvania. There apparently was a rule change that says that if you work in another state, you have to apply for unemployment benefits in that state, which I wasn't aware of. So out of that, I did not receive benefits for nearly 9 months.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's amazing to me. And I guess the question I have is, you know, you've been off for well over 99 weeks. How do you survive? Because unemployment is not, contrary to what our governor here, our governor-elect thinks, people aren't taking vacations. People aren't partying. This isn't the lap of luxury.
Right, it's not. And I've been able to survive, luckily, through a food bank, for one. Friends were another. My savings, unfortunately, took a hit three times altogether, in which I was completely drained of savings. And when I did finally receive my benefits from Delaware, that's another aspect of this, too, with the problem of filing out of state. I received those benefits the same day I ran out of money in my savings account. So that's how I've been able to survive. And for someone to say that I should switch careers and do something else, that's ludicrous. There are people that say to me that I should take just any old job, even a minimum wage job. Well, last week when I was down in Washington with about 500 other people, I had the opportunity to talk to Senator Casey, and I was amongst 10 others, and I said to him that there's no way that I can survive on a job making $7.25 or $7.50 an hour when apartments in my area, a one-bedroom apartment, goes for anywhere between $8.50 and $9.50 a month. That's just the apartment.
Right. You know, and I look at this and I say, you know, this is why I think we need to go back and pursue a living wage requirement instead of just a minimum wage. We're, you know, 7.25, I got to be honest, unless you're living in a very rural area where the cost of living is considerably cheaper, I just don't know how someone in Philadelphia or a major city could possibly live on that.
there's no way. Even out here in Upper Bucks County where I live, that's impossible, really. 7.25 just doesn't cover your basic needs. It doesn't cover your food, clothing, shelter. It just doesn't work, really.
So have your benefits run out?
They did run out. So I'm at a point where I'm wondering what's going to happen next, and I thought for sure today was going to be the answer, at least part of the answer, that benefits were going to be extended to the 99ers. But unfortunately, that wasn't the word that I heard. So that means us 99ers have to fight once more and harder to receive benefits like everyone else that's unemployed.
So let me ask you this. If nothing happens, where do you go from here? I mean, is there a potential that you could be homeless?
As a matter of fact, I am homeless. I lost my home 3 weeks ago, almost a month ago. It was on November 12th, and that was 2 weeks before my birthday, which was the day after Thanksgiving. I was evicted from my home at that time, and I was fighting to stay in my home during these past few years, working as hard as I could to keep it through a number of organizations and agencies and so on, and it just didn't happen. I was met with resistance from the law firms, one, that were fighting for the mortgage companies, and I also received no as a response to my request for help. So that left me in a very tough position to be able to hold on to my home. I did learn that Representative Shaka Fatah was pushing through Congress along with the Wall Street Reform Act, another act to help unemployed with saving their homes, which did in fact pass and was signed into law, but it has yet to go into effect because the rules and regulations are not in place both in Washington and here in Pennsylvania.
Let me ask you this. Are you hearing any talk of a possibility of passing extensions for people in your situation?
No.
Because I haven't heard anything. When I read it, I'm going, you know, this is a screw job for these folks. They were the ones hit first. These are the people who got taken down by the Bush recession right at the beginning. And
right, exactly.
They're the ones who've struggled through this entire process. And we can't help them?
Right, exactly. That's what's being said to us at this very moment, that the first people hit by this are those that have to find other means to literally survive.
Now, let me ask you, are there any opportunities for you to change careers? I mean, you know, it's one thing to say, okay, you know, Steve, change careers. Are there any avenues for you to get into job training programs? What? Anything like that that you know of?
Well, I'm sure they are out there, and people have suggested that to me. Ironically enough, since I did not have the internet at home, what I did was go to a local community college library, and I've seen people in my very same situation there, and I've heard various comments from them as to what they're doing to get retraining and so on. There's even a Career Link center there as well, and I've gone through all that. As a matter of fact, when Obama was first elected, I was part of the leadership of the job network group in Quakertown, and that was perhaps the fourth or fifth one that I've led over the past 20 years. So, yes, I'm well-versed in all of that. However, the problem is at the hiring end, and that is I have yet to get an interview.
How many resumes have you sent out? I'm talking to people who've sent out hundreds. One guy said 1,000.
Thousands, literally thousands. My last interview that I had was at a large agency in Philadelphia, and it was more like a cattle call because there were about 20 people in there being interviewed for all types of professional positions. If I had my home and the internet at home, I would be working now through another agency that would have allowed me to work as a 1099er, as a contractor. But because of that, I'm still unemployed. So, and even last week, I sent out probably 30 resumes or so to companies and law firms that had advertised on two job sites that I see most of the jobs on.
And, you know, the thing about that is it's not cheap either. I mean, if you're sending out paper resumes, there's nothing cheap about that.
Well, fortunately, they're online. If I had to send them through the mail, that would be a different story, yes.
And, you know, what I remember being unemployed long-term myself, and I remember, you know, back, you know, you'd put in an application and you'd never hear anything. And to me, there was nothing more depressing than trying, you know, to put your best foot forward, try to do, and then to hear nothing back.
Right, and that still goes on nowadays. The agencies, what they say to me and other people, just keep trying. If you have to, call me, leave a voicemail, send an email. Well, yes, I did that as well, and still the same thing, no response. I was creative, though, over the past few years by sending out Christmas messages to agencies, or holiday messages, I should say, and there were a few that did respond in kind, that they acknowledged the receipt of the message, so that kept them aware of who I am.
That's an interesting thought.
Yeah.
That's a good thought. Where do you see your future going from here? I'm sorry you're in the situation you're in, but where do you see yourself going from today forward?
Well, I've given it some serious thought about doing work on the other side of what I've done in the past. That is, like I said, I am a paralegal by profession, and the bulk of my work is in litigation. So litigation comes out of laws, and that is laws that are written. So I've been very active over the past 3 or 4 years with people that are unemployed and homeless and so on, working through a number of organizations, and have taken the activist route, and that's how this interview came to be, by the way, through friends of mine that are familiar with your show. I am involved with a number of organizations locally and also involved politically as well. So
I'm glad to hear that. I'm glad to hear that, because when you said you work in law and you wanted to work on the other side, I thought you were going to start talking about breaking the law.
No. No, being more of an activist, that's the perspective that I'm referring to. That's what I've been doing over the years, not only to help people, not only to help me with my situation, but to help others in my situation as well. That is, help the jobless, help the homeless, anyone that's going through what I'm going through. Not only am I doing it for me, I'm doing it for them as well.
That sounds like a great and noble activity. Steve, I appreciate your time. I wish you nothing but the best. I'd love to talk to you again at some time in the near future to check in and see how you're doing.
Okay, well, thank you for having me on your show.
All right, Steve, thank you so much. We're going to take a quick break. Right back with your calls, 1-888-520-7425. We'll be right back after this.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
At work, do you think you need an attorney? You probably don't. To protect yourself, you do need to know your rights. Retain control. Order your free book, The 7 Deadly Sins That Can Destroy Your Pennsylvania Workers' Compensation Case, by visiting workinjuryinsurance.com in PA.com or calling 695-4722. Don't be taken advantage of. Order your free book, The Seven Deadly Sins That Can Destroy Your Pennsylvania Workers' Compensation Case, by visiting workinjuryinpa.com or calling 695-4722.
Do you need a sign or promotional material for your business, campaign, or function? Then All Union Signs and Promos is the place for you. For years, All Union Signs and Promos has been serving South Central Pennsylvania with affordable, high-quality, union-made and American-made signs and promotional products. We want you to be seen. We set ourselves apart not only by being your one-stop, full-service sign shop, but also being able to tie that image into a full line of promotional products. Our dedicated staff will print, design, and deliver your most effective advertising tool on time and on budget. If you have a message, we have a sign. When you need your name on it, All Union Signs and Promos will do it with a memorable and unique union-made and American-made product. For more information about union-made and American-made products, visit our website at allunionsigns.com. That's allunionsigns.com. Or give us a call at 717-221-8888.
Making the blue blood see red. The Rick Smith Show.
Our quote of the day. Our quote of the day comes from the Washington editor of the Conservative National Review. She was moderating a Republican strategy session at the Hudson Institute on Friday. Her name is Kate O'Brien. She said, and it's, you know, again, how out of touch can you possibly be? She said, my question is, what poor excuse for a parent can't rustle up a bowl of cereal and a banana? I just don't get why millions of school children qualify for school breakfasts unless we have a major widespread problem with child neglect. She went on to say, if that's how many parents are incapable of pulling together a bowl of cereal and a banana, then we have a problem that are, we have problems that are way bigger than that problem can't be solved with a school breakfast. Because we have parents who are just criminally negligent with respect to raising children. Now understand, last month, the U.S. Census came out with a report that said we've got 14.3% of the population living under the poverty line. That is a 15-year high. And if you remember the Bush years, every year you saw poverty increase. So we've seen this major swing in poverty from the beginning of the Bush years all the way up until now. And look, the Republican poverty makers have succeeded. And you look at this statement. To me, someone needed to walk up and smack her upside the back of her head and make a citizen out of her. Because to me, that is just absolutely callous, cold-hearted, and stupid. I mean, think about that. I mean, but that's their vision. And right now, they're emboldened to say what they think.
It's an easy way. It's an easy way to avoid responsibility. And the Republicans are good at that.
And, you know, here's the thing. For me, I have always been an advocate of having a school lunch program, having a school breakfast program, not just for kids who are in poverty, but for all of the kids. Every kid in that school, it shouldn't be a matter of, oh, hey, you got to pay for breakfast. It should be there so that you have children that are ready to learn and they're getting nutritious meals. Because if we don't educate our children, if we continue to fall behind, we're screwed, man. And I look at this story in the Wall Street, or in the New York Times today. Sam Dillon writes, with China's debut in the international standardized testing, students in Shanghai have surprised experts by outscoring their counterparts in dozens of other countries in reading as well as in math and science, according to the results of a respected exam. American officials and Europeans involved in administering the test in about 65 countries acknowledged that the scores from Shanghai, an industrial powerhouse with some 20 million residents, and scores of modern universities that are the magnet for the best students in the country are by no means representative of all of China. So, you know, this is the place where they go. They sent about 5,100 15-year-old students to Shanghai to take this test. And I guess Reagan's Department of Education guy, Charles Finn, or Chester Finn, he said it, I think, best. He said, wow, I'm kind of stunned. I'm thinking Sputnik. And to me, that's a pretty big, it's a pretty big statement. Because if you remember when the Russians shot up Sputnik, mm-hmm. what did we do?
It shocked the world, actually.
Shocked the world. And that's kind of what they're saying about these, this PISA test, this program for international student assessment test, which is given to 15-year-olds in the, OECD countries, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development countries. Arne Duncan said this is a wake-up call. He said, I know the skeptics will want to argue with the results, but we consider them accurate and reliable. We have to see them as a challenge to get better. The U.S. came in 23rd or 24th in most subjects. He said, we can quibble or we can face the brutal truth. We are being out-educated. In math, they say, the Shanghai students performed in a class by themselves, outperforming second-place Singapore. Do you know where we finished? 31st. 31st in math. You know where we finished in reading? You know where we finished in reading? 18th. You know where we finished in science? Take a wild guess. 23rd. So when I hear all of my friends who love to say, we're number one, not in education. Not in education. In fact, we're getting beat by just about everybody. Just about the majority of the industrialized world. Now look, the students in Shanghai were told, you know, this is an important test. Our image is on the line. You need to do well. You need to study hard. And as this guy asked the question, he goes, what do you think would happen if you went to Chicago or really any major city and said, you know what? This test really matters to your school. This test really matters to your community. Do you think you would have some mass swelling of support? Maybe not. And what they're saying here is they're saying that the Chinese spend less time on extracurricular stuff. They study. They study for math and science and reading because they understand in order to be what we were, they have to be that much better than what we are. And I look at this and I'm going, you know, we have got to stop this bickering. And I look at these, well, we need magnet schools, we need cyber charter schools, we need everything we can possibly do to destroy public education in this country. And there are people who are spending millions of dollars doing it, making millions of dollars doing it. This whole, I love our system. We got a bunch of people sitting on school boards who I don't even think could pass a high school equivalency exam, yet they're dictating educational policy. I got someone who used a double negative in a sentence telling me that we ain't got no school choice. What? Where did you go to school? Doesn't this frighten you? It frightens me. And I worry about my children. What are they going to look forward to?
And all too often, what's the Republicans' mantra? Quality education isn't about money. Well, you know what? That's certainly on face, that's pretty fallacious because we have to spend money. We have to spend a minimal amount of money to have a good education. We need money for schools. We need money for teachers that are committed, for teachers that are educated. We do need money. Money isn't the only answer, but there has to be a commitment. And we don't seem to want to, well, you know, that's where your reference to local school boards. Many times it comes down to taxpayers who are mad because their school taxes went up. Therefore, they're going to run for school board and they're going to make sure that the costs are kept down.
Yep.
And all too often that means taking away from the quality of education for the kids.
You know, we need to go back to the way it was when I was in school. And I know I sound like an old codger. No, we need nuns. We need to bring the nuns back. We need sexually repressed, angry nuns with sticks. Because I got to be honest, the best education I ever got were first grade through seventh grade. Everything I learned in my whole life, I think I learned in first grade to seventh grade. Because those nuns beat it into me. Because it was that important. Yet here in this country, we need to establish self-esteem first. No, you need to have people who earn self-esteem. And I look at, you know, what China's doing, and look, they are spending a lot of resource. They're hiring quality people, and they're paying them. You know, here what bothers me is I don't think we're getting the best and the brightest into education because, one, it doesn't pay all that great. I mean, they make a reasonable living. But who wants to put up with the abuse? Who wants to put up with the constant media attack on teachers? I know I wouldn't want to do it. I mean, it's just mind-boggling. And for the people who do, for the teachers that are doing the job now, God bless you. Thanks, you're here. But I think you're underappreciated, underpaid, and overly browbeaten. A teacher does something nowadays, it's you know, it's like a criminal offense.
Well, you often tell a story about your football coach who kind of he saw you were a kid with a little bit of anger, and yes, I mean, part of it was selfish for him to want you to come out for football, but really, in a sense, that might have saved you as a young man.
Probably it absolutely did, but at the end of it, it was about having that respect and the fear. The guy grabbed me by the back of the neck, picked me up off the ground. And that was the end of that.
And said, I want you to come out for football.
And there's another problem with our education system. Our kids today don't fear anything. Me, I wouldn't have dared talk back to a nun. Because not only would I have gotten it from the nun, I'd have gotten it from my mother. Anyway, I want to take a quick break. We'll come back. We'll talk about this a little bit more. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. We're right back after this.
Someone like you, but I can believe what a crazy man you do.
Hey! Not right wing, just face. The Rick Smith Show.
Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
Chances are, when you took a shower this morning, an AFSCME member made sure that water was clean. When you drove to work, an AFSCME member maintained the road. When you rode an elevator, an AFSCME member inspected it. I'm David Filman, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. AFSCME members enforce regulations, keep prisoners behind bars, take care of patients, protect the environment, and more. The work isn't glamorous, the salaries aren't high, but AFSCME members serve the public in every aspect of our daily lives. Chances are, you'll never see that AFSCME member working in a sewage plant, diving underwater to repair a bridge, or answering a 911 call. But aren't you glad they do? For more information, visit AFSCME13.org. We are AFSCME.
We make history happen!
waving the flag of freedom for people, not corporations. Rick Smith.
Back to the Rick Smith Show, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Remember, check out our website at therickSmithShow.com. Also, December 18th through the 24th, we will be there at the Giant parking lot, right there, 255 South Spring Garden Street in Carlisle, doing our Hungry and Homeless for the Holidays event. If you want to donate, we're taking funds at hungryandhomeless.org. Everything is tax deductible. Goes to benefit Project Share and Carlisle Cares, the emergency shelter in the area. We will be there from the 18th all the way until noon on the 24th, collecting non-perishable food items, clothing if you have some stuff, especially warm stuff to help folks who are homeless during this winter season. And we're coming out to meet you guys, to get to know our audience a little bit better and to do some positive things. We're going to have a couple of church groups come out and do some singing, and we'll have the Bloodmobile there on the 23rd in case you want to donate blood. But a great opportunity for the community to come out and support Project Share, which does great work as a food bank, as well as Carlisle Cares, who is our emergency shelter. Let's go to the phone lines. Got Mark on line one. How are we doing today, Mark?
Oh, all right. Drove in from St. Louis. Yeah, I heard you talk. Are you talking about public education or private education?
Talking about education as a whole. The Chinese are kicking our behinds.
Well, what's your understanding of the word education?
I couldn't understand you.
What do you mean when you think of education?
I think of learning how to read. I think of learning how to do math. I think of science. I think of
skills.
Absolutely.
Okay, that's it?
Well, that's primarily the reason we started public education.
Yeah, that's a very truncated view of your reality, is that we've reduced life to skills. And that is directly from the modernist view of the world, is that you're reducing everything to just reading, writing, and arithmetic.
Well, at some point through all that, don't you learn? Because I'm a big fan of experiential learning. I'm actually a big fan of the Montessori system, which spends most of its time really doing things on an experiment, level. You're still learning, but you're doing. So I'm not quite sure where your attack's coming from.
Well, I'm sorry. I guess I was kind of on the attack, but. And it's the assumption that everything is just, that all that's important is skills and education, removes all questions of where we come from, why we're here, purpose, where we're going, morality. Everything that drives the inner person, or it doesn't even have to drive, but it's part of the being of a person, has been removed and gutted by this view of what we're teaching. When we elevate one thing, we reduce another. And this is exactly the problem. Is that we think we can actually have something called public education, and there's just no such thing.
Well, let me, you know, I go back to my years of schooling, and I had some very, very hard teachers who drilled education into me, but they made me a critical thinker as well. I think the system that we have today, where we're only teaching to the test, I think that's a problem. We're not training critical thinkers. We're not training people to investigate things. I don't want my kids to be like George Bush, who was not a very inquisitive person. And this is kind of what the article was talking about. The Chinese students thirst for knowledge. They're going after it on their own. They see it as a national pride. They see it as the national image. And to me, you know, my daughter who's 8, you know, the other day told me, you know, school's boring because they're not challenging her. She has no challenge. She's a good student. I've taught her just about everything that they're going to teach her this year, and she's bored.
Well, could it be? Let me just suggest. I mean this in a non-attack way, but that skills are just boring. I mean, if you're just teaching that how to add, subtract, multiply, do integrals, this happened when, you know, and these are sort of a sequence of events. When you make, when you teach everything with an amoral worldview, it sucks the soul and the purpose and the being out of it. And I mean, I heard you say that the nuns used to really be hard on you.
Oh, yeah, they were.
Okay, but see, that's, I mean, that's now a part of a community with a view, a worldview. And that's not public education. You're talking about private, and an education is part of a community, of a life. Am I right?
You're right.
So, I mean, are you saying that you want public education to be a part of something, a worldview, or have nuns, or what?
Well, I want public education to challenge kids. I want there to be an opportunity for my child to be challenged.
In what sense?
In the sense that as far as her talents, her skills, her interest, her inquisitive nature will take her, they will take her there. They will lead her in that direction and allow her to be what she can be.
Well, who made her? How'd she get here? Where's she going?
Well, that's a decision she's going to have to make, where she's going.
Oh, well, then you see, now you've already removed that out of the education. That's like entailing all these skills that you're talking about is resting these skills within a larger context, but you've already just destroyed that.
But as a society, don't you have to have a populace with minimum skills? At least minimum skills? I'm not saying that...
I don't know what your society that you're talking about. What society is this?
The community, right here where I live. If you're going to
have... Well, who is that? I mean, I don't even know. That's the problem with America today is we have all these anonymous people, automatons, that move about like atoms, and we don't have community. That's not a real thing anymore. They're just atoms. They're not even, they talk about a community, things that you hold in common. You're just speaking geographically now.
Okay, so let me ask you, what's your solution? If you don't agree with what I'm saying, where should we be going?
Well, we have to ask the questions first that matter.
Okay, and what do you think the questions that matter are?
What is reality? Why are we here? Who are we? Didn't say things like that. But did we get here? What is the purpose?
But those are philosophical questions people have been asking for, well, since the beginning of time, Mark.
Well, but the church, see, I'm a part of the church, which teaches... In the sense that we assert this is reality, that God created heaven and earth, that this is the Son of God who's come with all the authority from God, and that he has set up his kingdom here through the giving of his of the Holy Spirit. So reality.
Okay, if I'm getting this right, and I've only got another 2 minutes left before I got to take a hard break here. If I'm getting this right. We should not worry about science, not worry about math or reading, because we don't have the answers to who or why or what brought us here?
No, I do have the answers. I'm just saying that all those things that you're wanting to teach are divorced from the answers that you just eliminated the answers of what modernism does. And you kill everything that you're trying to do by doing that.
Interesting. I'm going to think about that a little bit more, Mark. I appreciate the thoughts. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Once you start getting into those philosophical debates, that can go on for days.
I don't get some of his points, to be honest. I understand what he's going. I guess he was saying we have to, and to some degree he's right if he's saying this. We have to teach kids moral values.
But that's done in the home.
We have to teach kids if we so choose to religious values,
yep.
And then go forward. I agree with that, but he lost me in some of those other things.
We're right back after this.
Radio of, for, and by We the Working People. The Rick Smith Show.
Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham.
these concessionary demands are unreasonable, unwarranted, and overly severe.
UAW Local 833 spokesman Dave Boucher on the cutthroat wage, pension, and benefits demands rejected by the workers at the Kohler Company plant in Wisconsin. The rejected concessions included 5-year wage and pension freezes, substantial hikes in health and other benefits costs, and a 2-tier workforce of new hires and recalled long-term layoffs who would be working at 65% of current pay with no union representation for the second-tier workers. Kohler and the UAW are trying to negotiate a new agreement that will be ratified by the 2,000 workers on Sunday. Public Citizen Global Trade Watch Director Lori Wallach says the Obama administration's Korea Free Trade Agreement is a betrayal of campaign promises Obama made to change NAFTA-style trade deals that have cost millions of U.S. jobs. The United Auto Workers Union supports the deal. The UAW says the Korea Free Trade Agreement will protect American auto jobs and grow more U.S. auto worker jobs. United Steelworkers President Leo Girard isn't buying it, and neither is the Machinists Union. Girard met with the USW board Monday to decide what to do on the issue. A statement is expected from the USW once its board has decided. Wallach says the Korea Free Trade Agreement is a U.S. job killer, and she's astounded by the UAW's support for it.
Maybe the most mortifying aspect of this whole thing is that the UAW has joined in on this betrayal that the Obama administration is perpetrating. Because specifically, the provisions that were negotiated in automobiles do not meet any of the criteria that the UAW itself had laid out as necessary for fixing this agreement so that it doesn't devastate U.S. auto workers as well as all of the related industries.
A new Pratt & Whitney contract will see 2 plants closed but 500 jobs preserved. Jesse Russell reports.
The 16-month battle between Pratt & Whitney and workers represented by the Machinist Union in Connecticut has come to a close. Under a contract agreed to by workers this weekend, aftermarket jet engine maintenance facilities in Cheshire and East Hartford will be shuttered by May of 2011. The Cheshire work will be moved to Georgia, while the East Hartford work will be moved to Japan and Singapore, in exchange for a 3% raise this year and 2.5 raises over the next 2 years. The company has asked for 500 workers to retire early. Employees who accept the buyout will receive a $20,000 bonus, plus a week's pay for every year of employment with the company. Half of the company's workforce is over the age of 50, so the union expects to be able to find volunteers fairly easily. After months of tough talk by the company about needing to cut jobs, the announcement on Friday of a $1 billion 20-year contract with Airbus may have reduced some of the urgency of moving jobs out of Connecticut.
This newscast was made possible in part by the National Education Association. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
It's the Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
Making the blood see red. The Rick Smith Show.
Rick, 1-888-520-7425. Remember, check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. You can watch us live here in the studio right there at the website at therickSmithShow.com. Also, please go to hungryandhomeless.org. Make a small donation to Project Share. It is tax deductible. It will go to every penny will go to help the hungry and homeless in our community. And please mark it on your calendars, December 18th through the 24th. We will be at the Giant, 255 South Spring Garden Street there in Carlisle, with our truck, hoping to fill it up and hoping that you'll help us out in doing that. You know, the whole point that I was bringing up in the last discussion on education is I don't think we're doing enough on a number of levels. At the end of our conversation with Mark, I get the feeling he wants a more religious-based education. I personally believe that's something for the home. That's something that parents should teach their children. I'm a big proponent of families doing that stuff together like we do with our children. I don't want someone else's influence if I don't have to have it. Education, in a public sense, is about learning how to solve problems, how to math, science, reading, that kind of stuff. The family values, the morality, I think that stuff comes from the home and from the parents in a perfect society. The sad reality is too often what has happened is that responsibility has fallen onto the backs of the schools. We're not, you know, for all the years I went to school, they had almost no sex education. Nothing. You got the basic anatomy and physiology explanation of human reproduction. Never the nuts and bolts, just the, you know, what your basic science book would talk about. And we had a large number of teen pregnancies. Studies have shown that if you give people information, they learn the you know, the nuts and bolts and how to protect themselves, they generally will. When you have this head in the sand, because the parents didn't. I mean, my grandparents, because I lived with my grandparents, we didn't have that conversation. They were either too tired or too busy or just didn't want to have it. So someone had to pick up that slack for society. And I know you could make the argument that we're not really a community, and that's a big philosophical discussion. I think in my neighborhood, I know my neighbors. I know where my daughter goes to school. There is a community there.
Well, I think part of that, and we've talked about this on our show before, I think part of that is our modern way of life. I know when I grew up in a quintessential blue-collar neighborhood, row houses. You know, everybody was very close. All the neighbors knew everyone else. All the mothers looked out for all the other children. Now, you know, what's the American dream, Rick? You buy a home, you put it on 4 or 5 acres, and you may or may not know your neighbor.
You get away from everybody.
And, you know, in that way, I mean, it's a clear difference. It's a clear way of living. In that way, he is correct. We aren't the communities we used to be, and part of it is you know, demographics. Yeah. And I think some of that is definitely a negative.
Yeah. And my problem is I personally don't believe we're spending enough on education. I think we should be investing more in the people who are our future. Because look, you know, I go back to the argument I had with my school district back when my daughter was in kindergarten. There were 30 plus kids in her class. And my argument was there wasn't even enough room in that classroom for them to trip over each other. Yet they wanted in a kindergarten level, to put all these kids together, their first experience is overcrowding. And I produced study after study that said, look, you know, we know that K through 3 are the most important years. That's when they get the basics. That's when they learn, you know, just your basic stuff. And if they fall behind, all of the studies that I have show that they never catch up. And you spend enormous amounts of resources trying to catch them up. It never happens. So I've always taken the position, and I would love to have longer school days, a longer mm-hmm. school year. I think doing more experiential learning is a positive thing. Like I said to Mark, I do believe the Montessori system is a better system, but it's labor intensive and it's expensive.
Well, you look at the countries that are kicking our butts. I mean, they have Saturday classes. I know that's a sacred cow, but, you know, if we're serious, more and more educators, though, are going to a shorter summer, longer school years. I think that's certainly not all the answer, but that's one of the things we probably should be looking at.
I mean, you do less hardcore drilling. You do more activities. There's a difference in opinion on how things get done. And I look at the story that I got today in the newspaper, our friend Kevin Stoner. He's the treasurer for the library system in Cumberland County. He went to the Cumberland County commissioners and said, you know what? The library system is struggling so badly, that we need money from you. The state has slashed the budget. They're not raising money. The libraries are in default. And to the Cumberland County, commissioners' credit, they came up with about $100,000. From their, from one of their funds. It's the, Strategic Development Fund to help cover this year's expenses for the libraries in Cumberland County. And I think that's a good thing. My only problem is Strategic Development Fund money, I don't think was ever meant to fund libraries. Well, I think it's a good thing that we're going to keep libraries open because, you know, like we talked to Steve Nathan, the guy who's been unemployed for well over 2 years. Where does he go? He goes to the community college libraries. As we've talked to other homeless people, unemployed people, where do they go? They go to the public libraries because there's internet access. There are resources there. To me, right now is the time we should be pumping more money into libraries and education, not less. But, you know, we've got these folks. We need to cut budgets. We need to cut, so we can hand billions and billions of dollars to the top 0.3% or 2% or whatever you want to, whatever percent you want to talk about being extraordinarily wealthy in this country. We need to give the pound of flesh.
Well, it offers services that, some people can't afford to buy. For instance, something as simple as a newspaper. I mean, you go to most libraries, they have two, three different newspapers. It helps people who perhaps don't have the resources to maintain as normal a life as they possibly can.
But anyway, that's an interesting thing, and I'm good for Kevin. And that he's everywhere.
And maybe we can look at I don't know, in the future, Rick. Maybe we can look at helping the library system out.
We got to do something.
Some kind of fundraiser.
I know my family uses the library often. The kids love to go and pick out books.
I can tell you, before I got my computer, I used to go to the library, and every day you'd see a lot of not the senior citizens, some, but most of them, a lot of middle-aged people doing exactly what you were talking about, looking for jobs.
Speaking of someone who doesn't have to worry about finding a job, Christine O'Donnell evidently has nearly $1 million left from her failed Senate run. Look, she raised $6.1 million. And what I love about that is she complained that the Republicans weren't giving her money. She raised $6.1 million. The largest amount of any race in Delaware. Oh, wait a second. I'm sorry. She raised $7.3 million. She spent $6.1 million. Nice.
I guess she kept that just in case she's going to need, and I think she is, she's going to need good lawyers.
She's going to need a good defense fund. Because as we talked about during the election, she had a history of, you know, pocketing some campaign money, using it for rent, using it for, you know, transportation, haircuts, you know, all of that stuff, which kind of legal. She wasn't paying her people, but she could, you know, pay her rent.
You know, nothing annoys people than somebody wants to run for a public office. He or she wants your trust. And before they're in office, they violate the law. I mean, how could you with a straight face say, trust me?
But again, it takes me back to this question that the folks who were talking about fiscal responsibility, the O'Donnells of the world, the guy down in Tennessee with $100,000 in credit card debt. These are the folks who are talking about fiscal responsibility on the national level, yet their own houses aren't in order. You know, I understand. Look, I'm as fiscally responsible, and I would be considered a fiscal conservative because I do believe you have to pay your bills. I do believe that if you want a program, you've got to raise revenue, or you've got to find the funding somewhere. You've got to stop borrowing. Borrowing in a time of economic crisis is a necessity. But the Bush years was not necessity. We should have raised taxes to pay for the two wars. Absolutely. We should not have handed out a couple of trillion dollars to the top 1% in this country. The Bush tax handouts were a failure. They didn't create the jobs they were supposed to, and they made the gulf between those who have and those who don't the widest this country has ever seen. We are right now more unequal with paid distribution than at any time in the history of this country. And, you know, I got to be honest with you, having myself driven a truck for years, as the unions were destroyed, you saw the trucking industry become one of those not so great paying industries. And I say what you have to have is you have to have the ability to make a good wage. Not a minimum wage, but a good wage. Because I do believe a lot of things can be solved by having folks making a little bit more money. You want to solve our deficit problem? Get people raises so they pay more taxes. Allow them to organize. Allow them to join unions and collectively bargain. You know, corporate America had the best quarter in the history of this nation in the third quarter. The best third quarter ever. Almost $1.7 trillion of in their pocket, divvy up amongst the investor class profits. What'd we get? Oh, yeah, we got almost 10% unemployment. So this idea that if we give them all this money, they're going to bestow employment upon us is ludicrous. And the debt commissions come out and say, well, what we want to do is we want to take that top rate down to 23%. And let's say we did take it down to 23%. Now remember, 1955, 92%. Kennedy administration, he dropped it down to 70. Reagan down to 50. Clinton down to 39.5. Bush down to 35.
Well, you know where that comes from, right?
Now they want to take it down to 23. Flat, and they still won't pay it.
Flat tax, fair tax, it's pretty much the same thing. That's what they figured about 23%.
No, they don't even want that. They don't want to pay any tax. You think even, do you really believe if there were a 23% tax on the very wealthy in this country that they would pay that? No, they wouldn't pay it. They want to get out of that, too. It doesn't matter what the rate. If the rate was 0.1% of 1%, they would still figure out a way. Would you stop that? They would still figure out a way of getting out of it. Anyway, let's take a quick break. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. We're right back.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Excellent news, people. After 3 years of financial doldrums and depression, money is on the move again. The economy is beginning to hum, and bluebirds of happiness are twittering with delight. People are starting to shake off what happened, trilled one of those bluebirds. The mood is absolutely better, exclaimed another. There is a dent buzz on the street, chirped yet another happy songster. Of course, none of these merry optimists are talking about your street or mine. Instead, the new surge of economic exuberance is being felt exclusively by those fortunate ones on Wall Street and in the executive suites of giant corporations. For example, the big five Wall Street firms, Bank of America, Citigroup, Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley, and J.P. Morgan Chase, have set aside $90 billion this year to lavish huge bonuses on their big-shot bankers. $90 billion. Also, major corporations are hauling in total profits this year of $1.7 trillion, the highest level ever recorded. Ever. Thus, reports the New York Times, the moneyed elites are walking with renewed swagger and indulging themselves once again with extravagances that we commoners cannot imagine. One insurance executive, for example, has doubled her annual cosmetic surgery budget this year. Then there's the Goldman Sachs executive who celebrated Halloween with a posh party of 1,000 of his best friends in a hip Manhattan nightclub. His bash featured an open bar and a performance by hip-hop star Lil' Kim, who appeared in a black cat costume. This is Jim Hightower saying, trick or treat, y'all. As these privileged pranksters play, the majority of Americans remain mired in a miserable, jobless economy with incomes falling, the middle class sinking, and poverty rising. As one Wall Street economist starkly says, this is unlikely to change in 2011 or 2012.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Bringing sanity and rational thought back to America. Rick Smith.
One of my favorite writers, he's a newspaper reporter. I think he's the last labor reporter in the country at a major newspaper. Stephen Greenhouse of the New York Times. When I was a kid, you had a labor page in the Cleveland Press. I still remember that there was actually a beat reporter who followed working class issues. You know, every newspaper across this country has got a business page. But I have yet to see one that has a labor page anymore. They used to when I was a kid. Not so much anymore. But Greenhouse is probably the last one. I think Dine, Philip Dine was, I think he was one, but I think they cut that department. Anyway, he writes, the Supreme Court on Monday agreed to hear an appeal in the biggest employment discrimination case in the nation's history. One claiming that Walmart stores had discriminated against hundreds of thousands of women in pay and promotion. The lawsuit seeks back pay that could amount in the billions of dollars. The question in this is not whether the claims of discrimination are valid or not, but rather if the claimants, all of the individuals who were cheated, whether they can combine as a class action. The court's decision on this issue will almost certainly affect all sorts of class action suits, including ones asserting antitrust, securities, and product liability. Which way do you think this case is going to go? I'm looking at this, going to say that the Supreme Court is going to throw this out. And they're going to side with the Walmart people. All of these folks, they're going to have to file individual lawsuits. I think that's how they're going to decide. Why do I think that? Doesn't take a genius to figure it out. That's the pro-business position. If we can separate the group, we can get each person off by themselves. We can, A, make it more expensive for them, more costly, and, of course, more time-consuming. That's why they want it.
Don't they risk, though, if you do that, Rick? I don't know how many litigants are we talking about here, hundreds?
Right now we're talking about, I think they were saying thousands.
Wow. Well, first of all, if they get their own representation, there are probably some that won't do that. But if they would, if everyone would get their own lawyer, Walmart risks, depending on the situation, some pretty big settlements individually. But the problem is it'd take years and years.
And they've got armies and armies.
Oh, no, do they ever?
You know, with multi-billion-dollar profits, you can easily hire an army of attorneys to tie this stuff up forever.
I remember when they were trying to put a third store in a medium-sized city, you know, Lebanon, which is not that, 35,000. I mean, you went to one of their public meetings. Oh, my. They had three or four lawyers there. They had this person in management, that person in management. They had a whole table, a whole legion to represent them.
For me, I got to be honest. You know, when I look at this, it's another failure of our labor system. The fact that we've got antiquated laws that need to be reformed and reformed almost immediately. Because you go back to the Ledbetter thing. The Supreme Court decided against Lily Ledbetter, a woman who had been discriminated for, you know, 20 years. And they said, well, gee, you know, you didn't file it within the 180 days of when it happened. Well, it started right from the beginning, 20 some years earlier. And she didn't know about it up until she retired. You know, it's one of those things where you go, yeah, and your point. How did you know? And as I had a story before where my wife used to work. She was a manager of a billing office. One of her employees told another employee what they made, they were both fired. That was it. Gone. No questions asked. Right in the rule book. And amazingly, with Pennsylvania being an at-will state, it stuck. You have no recourse to go after them. There's the door. And this is why I say, you know, I was a Teamster for 21-plus years. 21 and a half. I think you got to have a contract. I think you have to have that protection. You may not always agree with what goes on. And look, there were a lot of things in my 21 and a half years as a member that I wasn't always thrilled with. But at the end of the day, it was still about the members and it was still about that contract. Having that security in writing of what my responsibilities were, what wages, hours, conditions, all of that stuff were. Right there, black and white, without any gray area.
It always amazed me the lack of understanding the average worker out there. A lot of people don't really realize in our state, you can be fired for no reason. Literally no reason. You can come in tomorrow, unless you have a union contract, and they can tell you you're fired.
Unless they say, you old guy, get out of here.
Unless they violate
a federal law.
Federal discrimination laws.
Yes. And, you know, I go back to the trucking industry because that's where I spent the majority of my 21 and a half years. Over that time, I have seen the industry deteriorate. I've seen working conditions deteriorate. I've seen wages plummet. You know, I've seen the benefit levels go down, and I often wonder why it is that that industry never really stuck together. I mean, you know, you got Republicans in Congress right now, and some of the Tea Party folks and some of the other folks who are coming in saying we need to open up the Mexican border. This should be a catalyst issue for truck drivers in this country to say, look, you know, we don't have a problem with anybody driving a truck, but they should be making the same wage, at least what we're making. And I've got friends who, you know, they're gone all but 5 or 6 days a year. And at the end of the day, when they pay their bills and they pay all of their stuff, they got like 16, 17 grand that they made. I mean, you can make that flipping burgers. So I never got that whole, and I remember talking to folks on the road, you know, some of the ratchet jaws on the road, and you'd try and explain, you know, why they should participate, as a member. And I make my own deals. And I used to go, okay, that's all right, make your own deal. Most of the time they were bad deals until I realized that as many bad deals as they make, that eventually affects me. So as we saw deregulation take off and you saw the trucking industry splinter from about 16,000 companies in 1979 to, well over a million today, you saw the working conditions destroyed. And now I got friends who, you know, they live like animals in their trucks. They're caged. It's just sad. And it goes back again to our broken labor laws, which is why I said right from the beginning of the Obama administration, the Employee Free Choice Act should have been right up there in the top two or three things they did. Because I have a guy who emails me, and he's a Conway driver on the West Coast. And he says, you know, Rick, I've got all the guys at my terminal wanting to join a union, but the union's telling me that they can't organize us. And I got to tell this guy, you know, here's the reality. The reality is if you organize your one facility out of the, you know, 300 or 400 that the company has, they will simply move your work and you will all lose your jobs. What the guy told him is you got to organize the whole company. You know, eventually you've got to put everybody under one contract. And that's hard for some folks to understand, that it's that big, and these companies will do whatever it takes to deny you the right. Now, if we had stronger laws, if we had stronger labor laws, once you would organize that one place, you would have to negotiate to move that work out of there. They just couldn't pull it out like they do now. And that's the thing that I think folks need to realize. Once you have a written contract, there's a framework there.
Are they just in California?
Conway, they're all over the country.
Okay.
They're here. I mean, they're all over the country. They're a nationwide LTL carrier. But you look at some of these other companies. You have Mott's, for instance. The workers stuck together. They negotiated a contract. I don't think it was the greatest contract, but they did win the battle of losing all of their retiree health care, all of their health care, and being cut by $2 an hour in wages. Why? Because the companies see an opportunity, and the opportunity is to really stick it to us while they can now. And it's these times, you know, it's these times where people are willing to give up things just so I can feel secure. And that has, you know, on the job, in your personal life, privacy, this whole TSA thing, you do understand, was a distraction for the tax thing. Right, we're pretty clear on that. They put that TSA thing out there to get everybody all lathered up over there, so that they could push this tax handout for the wealthy. And look, I don't begrudge anybody of anything, but times are tough. They keep telling us constantly, we need to balance the budget. We need to find revenue. We need to cut spending. Explain to me how exactly it worked that we just handed out a couple $100 billion to people who don't need it and aren't going to use it to create jobs here. Because nobody can show me where tax cuts for the very wealthy has created any jobs.
Well, now you've come to the heart of what, you know, the left and the Democratic Party in Congress right now is saying. You know, how can we not win that? How can we not? They're saying rhetorically to the president, how can we not win that argument? And that's why they're angry. Something that much of a given, something that much of a truth. How can we not win that argument? How can we not win ultimately if we put a line in the sand and said, I will not allow you to add $800 billion to the deficit? Do you believe in deficit reduction or don't you? I understand that temporarily there's going to be people that suffer if they don't get these tax breaks. And there's going to be people that temporarily are going to suffer that don't get that unemployment insurance. But where do you choose to fight? What war is worth it?
And you know,
where do you choose to die?
That was the point from the beginning.
Where do you choose to die?
Nowhere.
You want to die?
The Democrats will not.
You want to die at the end of the next 2 years? I mean, you keep retreating, you're going to look around and find out that your back is against the wall and you can't retreat anymore.
Yep. Excellent point. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. We're going to take a break. I'll come back with your calls right back after this.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
Or dryer on the fritz, and you don't have the bucks for a new one?
Call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
You say that old refrigerator isn't refrigerating so well.
Call Mike at Klein's, 243-3211.
How about a bunch of money to replace your old stove or microwave?
Again, save the cost of a new one. Just call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Here at the radio station, we call Mike our resident mechanical and electronics genius. Have you ever met someone who can literally fix anything? That's Mike.
Call them at 243-3211.
You'd be amazed to learn how well many of the older appliances were made. A simple repair might give you another 5, 10, or even 20 years of service from that old washer, dryer, stove, or refrigerator at a fraction of the cost of a new one. Mike repairs TVs and electronics, too.
So call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Let Mike fix it right, and you pocket the savings.
That's 243-3211 for Mike at Klein's Appliances Repair Service.
Do you need a sign or promotional material for your business, campaign, or function? Then All Union Signs and Promos is the place for you. For years, All Union Signs and Promos has been serving South Central Pennsylvania with affordable, high-quality, union-made, and American-made signs and promotional products. We want you to be seen. We set ourselves apart not only by being your one-stop, full-service sign shop, but also being able to tie that image into a full line of promotional products. Our dedicated staff will print, design, and deliver your most effective advertising tool on time and on budget. If you have a message, we have a sign. When you need your name on it, All Union Signs and Promos will do it with a memorable and unique union-made and American-made product. For more information about union-made and American-made products, visit our website at allunionsigns.com. That's allunionsigns.com. Or give us a call at 717-221-8888.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Remember, check out our website at therickssmithshow.com. Also, I want you to mark your calendars, if you would, December 18th through the 24th, Christmas Eve there. We're going to be living in the giant parking lot, 255 South Spring Garden Street, right there in Carlisle, raising food for the food bank, some donations for both the food bank and the emergency homeless shelter, and just some basic goodwill, getting out, meeting everyone, and hopefully raising awareness to this issue. You know, I got to be honest, the unemployed guy we talked to earlier, I was not expecting him to also be a homeless guy either, which is what this whole recession has done to people. And like the guy said, he's worked his whole life. And a number of people that we've met over the past couple of weeks worked their whole life, never asked for anything from anyone, and now they have found themselves on hard times. And I think this is the time where, as a community, we come together and we fight back.
The food bank being kind of like a bank. There's times when you make deposits, and sometimes when you make, you know, you take things out. don't think that there might not come a time in your life where you're going to need to take take some of that food out of a food bank.
Yep.
So maybe if you have a job and you feel fortunate, it would be nice for Christmas and for the needy to help out. By the way, anybody out there, we've tried to contact as many businesses as we could, but if we didn't contact your business and you want to get together with the people you work with and maybe collect groceries, or better yet, collect some money, come on out to the parking lot, and we will give your company a shout out.
Again, hungryandhomeless.org is the website if you got a couple of bucks. Let's go to the phone lines. Got Mark on line one. How are we doing tonight, Mark?
Good. How are you?
I'm fantastic.
Thanks for taking my call. You had mentioned earlier about the Employee Free Choice Act, and I'm wondering, what are your thoughts of why Obama seemed to never really do anything with it? I'm a big union guy, the same as you. The Teamsters spent a lot of money in that campaign to get him elected, as did other unions, other organizations, rightfully so. Why do you think he never, why didn't it go anywhere?
Well, I would say 40 Republicans, three, maybe five bent knee corporate Democrats, the two Walmart senators and the Nelson twins come to mind. That's the reason. They didn't have the votes in the Senate. And everything stopped in the Senate. Now, my problem with it was, even if you don't have the votes, this is where I think Harry Reid's leadership was a little lacking. You put it out there, and you let people know where your opponents stand, have the votes. And they just didn't do it. They were trying to work some deal.
What about the miscommunication, the misconceptions of what the Employee Free Choice Act really are?
Well, I mean, the big money, you know, the big money in the Chamber of Commerce and all of the, you know, the think tank money beat everybody on the messaging.
Right. Everybody thinks that it's going to do away with the secret ballot.
Right.
That couldn't be further from the truth. It takes that choice to go to a secret ballot out of the employer's hands.
Yep.
And it puts it in the employee's hands. They're the ones that say, yes, we want the election, or no, we don't. We just want to be union. Whereas now, the way it's written now, the employers, on when the organizer goes for the demand of recognition, the employer says, yes, we'll take you, or no, you're going to go to a ballot.
And they,
I don't.
Well, look, here's the thing, Mark. They know that is from the right-wing perspective is a great argument. To them, that wasn't important. That was the message that they put out to the people who know nothing about the issue. Because, you know, it sounds anti-American. What they were really afraid of is the binding arbitration. The fact that they had to come up with a contract in a set amount of time.
Absolutely. Because the way it is now, it's all in the employer's hands. The power resides with them because they drag it out. Then all of a sudden, after that year, the guys start. The employees, I shouldn't say guys, but everybody starts to get restless. Where's our union contract? Next thing you know, they want to be certified. Where with that binding arbitration, they're going to get it. They're going to get that contract, and that first contract is the most vital part of it.
Yeah, I remember organizing a company up in Scranton when I was out of the Scranton local, and the owner of the place said, there will never be a union here. You will never get a contract no matter what you do. And there was nothing, you know, nothing the labor board would do. And eventually the guys, you know, like you said, they grew tired of a year-long battle where they were constantly getting fired and constantly breaking the terms of the agreement. And finally the guys just kind of let it be. And it's because our labor laws have no teeth, which is what the Employee Free Choice Act would have done. It would have put a little bit, not what I would have liked to have seen, but a little bit. Now, understand, from my perspective, the Employee Free Choice Act was a compromise because they thought maybe Bush would have signed it. This was a Bush-type compromise. When Obama came into office, I would have thrown strike replacement in there as well and made it much stronger for working people. But that didn't happen either.
I agree with the strike replacement, but I would have been satisfied with just getting the Employee Free Choice Act In the compromise version. We need, and I don't think that if we get the Employee Free Choice Act, that you're going to wake up tomorrow morning and 80% of the country would still be unionized. There are many people. I work in a non-union environment now, and there are many people there that don't have the guts to go forward. They're too afraid of the company.
Well,
even with the Employee Free Choice Act, they would still be afraid of the company.
Right, but this is where you have to put some teeth in the law that says if you fire someone in violation of the law, there are some draconian penalties. And again, you take it back to the power of the people. This collective group here, they've got to stick together through this. That's my thought.
I agree. I agree completely.
I appreciate the call, Mark. Thank you so much.
Thanks for your time.
Call anytime. I think about this often. This compromise bill, and we've talked about this a number of times. It was a compromise during the Bush years in the hope that maybe he would sign it. They could tack it onto something where it wasn't so offensive to him that he would just sign off on it. And he didn't because nothing benefiting labor would ever come out of the Bush family or Elaine Chao. And I've said her name twice tonight. Chao, Chao, Chao.
And you know who her husband is.
Yeah.
Mitch McConnell, boy, that's a marriage made in heaven, isn't it?
Yeah. Man, that just thinking of her, and like I really like Hilda Solis. I really think she's a good labor secretary. I just think right now this Korean free trade agreement, I'm still digesting it. My anger, my juices are still trying to find their rightful place, if you will, because I just think this is a bad move. Especially now. You're talking about over the next 5 years the possibility of losing almost 160,000 jobs. And, it's another one of these NAFTA-type agreements. And look at NAFTA. Did it make Mexico that much better? I would argue no.
Actually, it made it worse.
I would say it made it much worse.
Yes, it did.
And it made our situation that much worse. My problem with the Korean thing is there's an opportunity to see more Chinese products here through the back door. There's an opportunity for the Korean government, who's been lobbying our Congress for years, to demand laws and to overturn some of our laws. I mean, that's the part of these trade agreements that just blows the mind.
It would be interesting to hear the UAW's explanation on that. Maybe we can get somebody on from there.
Well, as I understand it. Right now, I think we're allowed to import 7,000 vehicles into Korea with the emissions exemption at a certain, I think it's an 8% tariff right now. This agreement will move that eventually up to 75,000, get the exemption at a 4% tariff over the next 5 to 7 years. Then after that, the tariff goes away. Now, in return, and this is, I guess the way that the UAW is looking at it is that's an increase of, 68,000 cars. So we're going to be able to build 68,000 more American cars.
Are they limited to 75 even after that 5 years?
Yeah, as I understand it. It's just the tariff goes away. So they're thinking, hey, we're going to build another 68,000 cars, which one of the bloggers who runs Fire Dog Lake came up with about 800 jobs, given the time, and 800 jobs a year. So they're basing it on we can add 800 members. Now, my problem with this agreement is who's to say that they're going to create those 800 jobs here? Because you got a 35% content, domestic content rule. Only 35% of that car has to be made here in the U.S., so you could have 65% of Chinese-made products in that car on both ends, not just here in the U.S., but also in Korea. So this could be a boom for them. That's my problem. I mean, I went on the lot. I looked at a Ford Mustang the other day. I'm dreaming about
being a nice car.
Dreaming about being 20-something again, single, driving around, looking, doing what you do at that age before you're married. And, I'm never going to get the car. I'm never going to be able, she's never going to give it to me. She's never going to let me have it. But it's nice to look at it, think about it. And I'm looking at the sticker that the transmission is made in China.
Wow, I didn't know that.
I didn't either. That's why I'm looking at it. I'm going, really? The transmission's made in China. So for me, again, my problem with this is that 35% content rule, where the European Union, they were able to negotiate a 55% rule. I would say if you want to see, this is where for me it comes down to. If we want to have a trade agreement with China, with Korea, it should be that they're actually things that are made in Korea, actually things that are made in the U.S., and that you trade those things. But these agreements are more about moving money around than products. It's more about having that open capital border.
Well, there's a legitimate issue, and you raised it. You know, what about the hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars? And it might be more than that over the last 30 years, the last 50 years, that we spent in defense of Korea. What about that? Shouldn't that be worth something?
Absolutely. And I would have said if I was a negotiator, I would have used that as a major bargaining chip. Look, you got a crazy little nitwit up top, up above you, who wants to come down and wipe you out and take up all your stuff. Gee, that's got to be worth something. That's got to be some. Any first-year negotiator knows when you've got a bargaining chip, you might want to use it. But we just didn't. And you got to understand, though, who these trade agreements are for. They're not for you and me. They're not for working people. They don't care about us. We're just tools. We're just cogs in the wheel to be used and discarded. It's about the financiers. It's about Wall Street. It's about big multinational corporations. It has nothing to do with you. They could care less about. They could care less about workers in any country. Because as one of our callers said tonight, they're capitalists. They're chasing the biggest buck. And for me, we've just handed out a couple $100 billion to the investor class, the top 2%. And where do you think that money could end up? Could end up over in Korea or China. Because they're chasing the best return. That simple. Anyway, let's take a quick break. We're right back after this to wrap things up. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Now in the midst of a brand new world economy, I don't believe them, I won't despair. They are a group and they're coming back to stay. 2% can't climb back up to 50% once again, my friend.
Uncovering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
When you took a shower this morning, an AFSCME member made sure that water was clean. When you drove to work, an AFSCME member maintained the road. When you rode an elevator, an AFSCME member inspected it. I'm David Thillman, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. AFSCME members enforce regulations, keep prisoners behind bars, take care of patients, protect the environment, and more. The work isn't glamorous, the salaries aren't high, but AFSCME members serve the public in every aspect of our daily lives. Chances are, you'll never see that AFSCME member working in a sewage plant, diving underwater to repair a bridge, or answering a 911 call. But aren't you glad they do? For more information, visit AFSCME13.org. We are AFSCME.
We make reparations happen!
We keep South Central Pennsylvania wired. We are the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, Local 143, right here in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. And for 93 years, we have proudly provided our contractors and their customers with the highest skilled and best educated electricians in the industry. Whether it's wiring a light socket in a Habitat for Humanity's home or replacing a vital component on a nuclear reactor, our professional electricians do the job right the first time. Our members are the backbone of our community and our nation, working to make tomorrow a brighter day. If you want to join us, or if you need an electrician for your industrial or commercial project, call us at 717-232-7093 or visit our website at www.ibewlocal143.org. We are the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, Local 143, and we keep South Central Pennsylvania wired.
Always by your side.
Radio of, for, and by We the Working People. The Rick Smith Show.
What the hell are we fighting for? Just surrender and water down. Just by time to say your prayer. While you're waiting for the hammer to fall.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out our website at therickSmithShow.com. Also, you can email me, Rick, at TheRickSmithShow.com. Anyone who we gave books away last week, Sarah Rock, who is the woman, the homeless woman who wrote a book, Nine Nations Under One Shelter, I got to be honest with you, went to pick them up the other day. She's completely out. I will have them to you. By Friday, she's supposed to get a new shipment. I will make sure that I get the first 10 copies out, because that's what I gave away. So I will make sure that those get out on Friday. So I'm hoping you'll get it before the big holiday. So I wanted to make sure you got that, because I don't want people thinking, well, you said I want a book, and I didn't get it. Well, I went to pick them up on Saturday night, and unfortunately fortunately for her. She had, for her and her husband, they had sold all of them. So that's good. Good stuff. With the holiday season right here, and again, our Hungry and Homeless for the Holiday event is coming up December 18th through the 24th. We'd like everybody to come out, drop off a can of corn, you know, maybe a case, whole cart full would be great too. Whatever, any non-perishable food item we would love to take, fill up our truck so that we can fill the coffers of Project Share so that they can start the new year off right. Also, if you want to donate a couple of bucks, hungryandhomeless.org is a place where you can make a PayPal credit card payment, tax deductible. The money goes to that account, which is then split between Project Share and Carlisle Cares. But, you know, with the holiday season, now's the time to help. But there's some folks who want to be Scrooges, and we've got a list of them.
Yes, we have. Jobs with Justice has their annual Scrooge of the Year Award, and for those of you who are interested in voting, you know, you can simply go to jwj.org. That's jwj.org, and you can vote among the following individuals. Number one, first and foremost in the Congress, Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell was nominated for leading the Republican Party in aggressively blocking legislation that would benefit working people. Express Scripts, one of the odds-on favorite here at our show.
I just voted for him.
Was chosen because, despite racking up profits of about $1.7 billion last year, by processing 12% of the nation's prescriptions, the company is demanding draconian concessions from workers and threatening to close facilities. Hyatt, the big hotel chain, was nominated for trying to eliminate quality health care coverage and make the recession permanent for its employees and for the Hyatt safety record. Rite Aid was chosen for failing to bargain a first contract with workers who joined a union 2 years ago and for demanding unreasonable concessions,
you know,
from other workers.
Exactly what we were talking about in the last segment with Mark, the caller. You know, here's a company that, you know, not, the workers said this is what we want.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they had a majority. They had the, you know, the law was on their side. And what's happened? Here we are, what, 2 years now?
Yes. One of their shops is literally feet from here. Publix was selected because it won't join other companies in pledging to improve wages and working conditions for the farm workers who pick the company's tomatoes. Gramatica Vineyards is a candidate because of its long history of intimidating and bullying workers and violating their rights. The healthcare industry and Pharmax industry was nominated for its single-minded focus on profits at the expense of our health. Again, that's JWJ.org. Please take the time and cast your vote.
Yeah, I just voted for the Express Scripts folks because I think that's unconscionable. I mean, this is a company that's wildly profitable. Their employees have built that company, and they're basically taking this recession and saying, you know what? Now we got an opportunity to really, really turn the screws, and that's what they're trying to do. You know, again, you see this, and it's one of those things that just makes you angry.
Well, you know, the more you see, Rick, sometimes I almost hate to admit, maybe what needs to happen is that the bottom almost fall out, and you have so many people suffering on such a massive scale that the nation will finally rise up and say enough is enough. You wonder sometimes how far it has to go.
Well, you know, as I said from the beginning, you know, and this goes back to right when the collapse happened. I said maybe the best thing that can happen is that everything, the bottom falls out, and we have mass suffering, and we have struggle like no other time, so that people remember. I mean, I gotta be honest. You know, I remember the folks. My mother worked as a nurse's assistant at a nursing home, and the folks who were in that nursing home, and this is back in the 70s, back in the early 70s, these folks lived through the worst time in this country's history, right there through the Great Depression. And the stories that they told, I mean, really were burnt into my mind because as bad as we had it living where I did, and, you know, I grew up in a housing project on the west side of Cleveland, which was not the greatest zip code. There was not a good, wasn't a good address. But as bad as I had it there, the stories they told were of things 1,000 times worse. Of people actually starving on the streets and walking aimlessly to look for work where they had no idea where they were going. And there's part of me that thinks, you know, maybe we need that again so that people begin to start thinking about class solidarity and coming together. I'd hate to see it, and look, the Democrats aren't going to do it because they could have. Look, they could have opposed Bush's bank bailout. They could have opposed handing out money to the tax cuts during the Recovery Act. They could have opposed all that stuff, and the economy could have tanked. And they could have had the political win. Remember, there's a difference between politics and governing. And politically, they just didn't have the stomach to let this economy and this country collapse. They just didn't have it. I believe only the Republicans have the stomach for that kind of destruction. And if we let them, they will do it. If we let them, they will absolutely do it.
And I guess my question is, you know, with the tremendous issues that the Republicans and Democrats are going to have to tackle, when is it going to get? When are these tough decisions going to be easy in the sense that we're not going to hurt anybody? We're going to have to make tough decisions, and people are going to get hurt. And the question is when. I say, the sooner you confront them, the better we are.
Yeah. Well, we're going to see. Anyway, one of Labor's great friends, one of Labor's great voices, Ann Feeney, who's been on this program a number of times. We play some of her music occasionally. A great voice of Labor. She has lung cancer, and as I understand, she's not doing all that well. Some folks have thrown a benefit concert together for her. So anybody who lives out near Millvale, which I guess is somewhere out near Pittsburgh. On Sunday, December 12th, they're going to have a benefit concert with a whole bunch of bands coming together to try and raise money to help her. And I got to be honest, this is kind of one of those we need to take care of our own. We need to help because she has been there for our causes so many times. So if you're interested, ticketweb.com/Mr. Smalls is a place where you can go to get tickets, or you can email me here at rick@therickSmithShow.com, and I will put you in touch with the folks who can help out and get you tickets there. Again, thanks for being here. I want to thank Jake for being here. Brett, the guy who slides our knobs and tubes, our chief engineer there. I want to thank you guys for being here, our guests, Lori Wallach, and, of course, Steve Nathan, best of luck to him. And thanks for everybody who called. Appreciate your phone calls and your thoughts, your comments. Again, remember, check out therickSmithShow.com for any information about the show, and also hungryandhomeless.org if you're interested in donating to our food drive event to help out the local community and help out the food bank. We would surely appreciate it. Again, all tax deductible. Have a great night, and we will see you back here tomorrow.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email rick@therickSmithShow.com or interact with us anytime at therickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's coming like the tide and flood beneath the Buddha sway. Imperial, mysterious, and amorous ray. Democracy is coming.
It's the
Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
Well, they're stealing down on Wall Street.